Good morning. We're going to call this meeting of the TRPA Governing Board to order. The date is Wednesday, December 15, 2021. It's currently 11:16. The first item on the agenda is roll call. Mario, would you please call the roll?
Ms. Olding.
Here.
Mr. Bruce.
Here.
Mr. Woloshin.
Here.
Ms. Conrad Sadoff?
Here.
Ms. Faustinos? Mr. Friedrich?
Here.
Ms. Gustafson?
Here.
Mr. Hicks?
Here.
Ms. Hill?
Here.
Mr. Honigman?
Here.
Mr. Lawrence?
Here.
Here.
Oops. Sorry about that, Jim. I thought you should have rise.
That's fine.
Ms. Novosel? Mr. Rice?
Now it's my turn. Here.
Ms. Williamson?
Here.
Mr. Yates?
Still here.
Maria, did you get me? I'm sorry.
Thank you, Sue. Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Excellent. Okay, we'll now go over the meeting rules for the day. Catherine, could you help us with that, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. To observe and participate in the meeting, go to www.trpa.gov, select December 15th, 2021 Governing Board meeting on the calendar, and follow the link to the webinar. Members of the public can find all meeting materials there as well. To participate in this governing board meeting with your comments, please use the hand-raising function in the GoToWebinar platform at the appropriate agenda item. If you wish to make a comment about something not on the agenda, the governing board will hear your comments during the general public comment period at the end of the meeting. With your hand raised, you will be unmuted by TRPA staff and have 3 minutes to address the governing board. If you have contacted the TRPA for reasonable accommodation and received a unique PIN for dial-in, please make sure you enter that PIN so that you may be identified and unmuted by TRPA staff. If you are using GoToWebinar's Instant Join web app, please make sure it is opened in the Google Chrome browser and that you allow access to your microphone in order to be unmuted. If you are joining via the call-in number posted on our website, please note this is a listen-only option. If you wish to address the governing board, you will need to log in via GoToWebinar on your computer, tablet, or smartphone, or dial your unique PIN. For governing board members, if you wish to speak, please alert the chair via the chat function if you are online, or speak up if you have called in. Please set your chat box now to message panelists and organizers to ensure that the chair sees your message. Remote board members may only use the chat function to indicate a desire to speak. This function must not be used to have sidebar conversation. Please remember to mute your microphone unless speaking to cut down on background noise. And finally, if you have not already, please turn on your cameras as we have sufficient capacity on the platform to accommodate everyone.
Great. Thank you so much, Catherine. Would you please lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. Okay, we're going to go to approval of agenda. Are there any changes to the agenda?
There are no changes, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. So we'll deem the agenda approved as posted. Item four, approval of minutes. We have a set of minutes from November 17, 2021 on page 9 of your packets. Any questions, comments, or changes? Seeing none, hearing none, do we have a motion?
So moved.
Okay, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. We'll move to item number 5, TRPA consent calendar. There are five items on consent, one of which is reviewed by Operations and Governance Committee and four which were not reviewed by any committee. As a reminder to the public, after board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in the GoToWebinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. Shelley, would you please provide us with a summary on the November financials from your Operations and Governance Committee this morning? Do we have Shelley? Do we have the Vice Chair from Operations?
I don't know. Am I it? No, there's Shelley.
Thanks, Shelley.
Excellent. Hi, Shelley. Sorry about that.
Sorry, I just had somebody pop in who had to talk to me quickly. So where are we? Are we on the minutes?
Yeah, we're actually, we got through that luckily without you. Normally we need you.
Well,
we were able to get it. Oh, hold on. We're not there yet. So yeah, we passed. We're good. So where we are right now is a consent calendar, and we're asking for a summary of the financials.
Well, everything is looking good, thanks to Chris and his staff. We are, everything, income is coming in. Obviously, our expenses are normal. So there was a unanimous recommendation from the Ops Committee to approve the November financials.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Okay, the second item on consent is Governing Board Committee membership appointments. Information on this item can be found on page 77 of your packets. Are there any questions or comments from board members on this consent item? I'm going to look at my chat. I'm going to look for hands. I don't see any. The third item on consent is the Incline Village Community Hospital Area Addition Project, 880 Alder Avenue, Washoe County, Nevada Assessor's Parcel Number 132-011-07, TRPA file number, ERSP 2021-0954. Information on this item can be found on page 81 of your packet. Are there any questions or comments on this consent item? Seeing none, I don't see anything in the chat. The fourth item on consent is the annual local government coordination report and action on recertification of City of South Lake Tahoe's El Dorado County's and Placer County's permit delegation memorandum of understanding and adopted area plans. Information on this item can be found on page 129 of your packets. Are there any questions or comments on this consent item? Seeing none, hearing none. And the final item on consent is a resolution affirming TRPA application filing fee schedule. Information on this item can be found on page 151 of your packets. Any questions from the board members on this item? Seeing none, hearing none. We'll now go to public comment on this item. Any member of the public wishes to address the governing board on any consent item, please raise your hand now and go to webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff, and I'll pass it over to Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Okay, thank you. We'll close public comment. Do I have a motion on the consent calendar?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. Thank you. I heard Bill Yates. Let's see. Maria, would you please call the roll?
Ms. Alding?
Yes.
Ms. Conrad Seda?
Yes.
Mr. Walashin?
Yes.
Ms. Faustinos? Yes. Ms. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Friedrich?
Yes.
Mr. Lawrence?
Yes.
Ms. Gustafson?
Yes.
Mr. Rice?
Yes.
Mr. Honigman?
Yes.
Ms. Williamson?
Yes.
Ms. Novosel?
Yes.
Mr. Yates?
Yes.
Mr. Bruce?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Thank you. Before we move to the next agenda item, we need a motion to adjourn as the TRPA and to convene as the Tahoe Metropolitan Planning Organization. Do I have a motion to adjourn and convene?
Moved. So moved.
So moved. Thank you. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. We are convened as TMPO, and we're on to item 6, TMPO consent calendar. There's one item on consent, which was reviewed by the Operations and Governance Committee. As a reminder to the public, after board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in the GoToWebinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comment. Shelley, do you have a summary with respect to the Title VI program plan and limited English proficiency plan from your Operations and Governance Committee meeting this morning? Shelley, are you on mute?
I am. So do I have to start over?
Please. Okay.
All right. It was a relatively brief discussion. There were some minor changes to the plan. This plan needs to be updated every 3 years. Thankfully, there were no complaints filed pursuant to Title VI. So the agency is doing a good job of meeting its legal requirements. So the committee recommended unanimously to approve the updated plan.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Any comments or questions from the board members on this consent item? Hearing none, seeing none, we'll now go to public comment. If any member of the public wishes to address the governing board on this agenda item, please raise your hand now and go to webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff, and I'll turn it over to Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Thank you so much. Do I have a motion to approve the consent calendar for TMPO?
So moved.
So moved.
Okay. Thank you. We have a motion. All in favor, please say aye. Actually, I'm sorry. Maria, will you please read the roll?
Ms. Conrad Seda?
Aye.
Ms. Aldine?
Yes.
Ms. Faustinos? Mr. Woloshin?
Yes.
Mr. Friedrich?
Yes.
Ms. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Gustafson?
Yes.
Mr. Lawrence?
Yes.
Mr. Honigman?
Yes.
Mr. Rice?
Yes.
Ms. Novacell?
Yes.
Ms. Williamson?
Yes.
Mr. Yates?
Yes.
Mr. Bruce?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Thank you. Okay, before we move on to the next agenda item, we need to adjourn as the TMPO and reconvene as the TRPA. Do I have a motion to adjourn so and moved. Reconvene? Thank you. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes, and we're moving to agenda item number 7, planning matters. 7A, Tahoe Keys Lagoons Aquatic Weed Control Method Test Project Update. Let's see. Information on this item can be found on page 205. As a reminder to the public, after staff presentation and board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in the GoToWebinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. At this point in time, I'd like to turn the meeting over to Joanne and Dennis to present this, and then we'll have questions and comments following that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joanne Marchetta, for the record, and I will be kicking this off. We're going to be moving through a series of speakers today on this item. And today's presentation is on the very important number one aquatic invasive species threat to Lake Tahoe. This is an information only item today, and it will be longer than normal. certainly longer than we like, because we're going to use this briefing today to bring our newest governing board members, as well as the public, onto a base of common information. And it's going to serve as a refresher of important context ahead of next month's decision hearing for those of you who have lived with this issue for many years and are already familiar with the project's history. I think it's important to understand what got us here and all that we've been through and all that we've tried, how many times we've been set back or stalled in seeking solutions, because now what we're facing is an ever more urgent problem because we've not been able to move the set of collective interest to any agreed approach as of yet. And we face a growing risk of overall, really at this point, system failure in an entirely different, more systemic lake-wide problem. I'm going to begin kind of at the 60,000 foot level today, and then subsequent presenters are going to progressively drill down for you. Our objective this month is to digest a lot of information so that next month's decision hearing on the test options, maybe we can make our presentations just a little bit more streamlined, but at least you won't be hearing it for the first time. So the Tahoe Partnership agrees on an important shared interest. Invasive weeds introduced decades ago in the Tahoe Keys lagoons are the number one aquatic invasive species control threat to the Keys and, more importantly, to greater Lake Tahoe itself. TRPA has been leading the work to combat aquatic invasive species in the Tahoe region since 2007, just after we discovered the invasive quagga mussels at nearby, kind of in our backyard at Lake Mead. And the 40-plus partners organizations that are part of the Aquatic Invasive Species Partnership agree that the number one threat in AIS control is here at ground zero in the Tahoe Keys lagoons, where the aquatic weeds infestation, it's serious, it's growing, and it is of increased concern to at this point, even public health, as well as being an actual threat of spread to other locations in the lake proper. So the Keys lagoons hold by far the largest infestation within the Tahoe region. It's 172 acres, and it's greater in size than all other Tahoe marinas combined. The weeds have now escaped the lagoons to spread to nearby areas of Lake Tahoe, and the new lake infestations are now compounding many of the more satellite invasive weed population at sites all around the lake. We know that the Keys Property Owners Association has been working on the aquatic weeds infestation for about 50 years, a very, very long time. And in spite of all that effort, there has never been an agreed upon or a fully successful or a clear path forward for the lake. And so the private owners have tried and they've tested and they've tried something else and they've tested more, and there have been no full solutions. And so the size and the complexity of the problem now continues to grow. And now the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association, which you'll hear them referred to as TKPOA, they are under a state of California regulatory order to find a solution. And they need to act and they want to act. And it's fair to say that their frustration runs deep at this point as they struggle to move to implementation and move to what may seem like, you know, move through what may seem to them like government obstacles and moving those out of the way. So the problem here, I want you to understand, is not coming to you as a typical land use planning or natural resource planning process. It instead has this long history, and it arises in this highly complex regulatory scheme under the Clean Water Act that can be very confusing to the public and even to those of us who are familiar. It's where a large and diverse group of private property owners are now being required by the Lahontan Water Board, the Regional Water Quality Control Board, to control a pollutant of concern on their private property in the lagoons. And that is the aquatic invasive weeds in the Keys Lagoons. So you've got roughly 1,500 private homeowners within the TKPOA who own the lake bed and are needing to do treatment for those weeds. And in response to the Lahontan regulatory order, the Keys Property Owners Association is the applicant here for a permit, and they are now required ultimately to propose an acceptable and legally sufficient plan to control invasive weeds in those Keys lagoons. So 5 years ago, this was 2017, TKPOA faced early opposition to its first comprehensive control proposal, because that would have included the broadcast treatment using approved aquatic herbicides. And so the project stalled at that point, as it has so many times before, and the applicant struggled to provide all of the information required and to satisfy all the public fears and the concerns about what remedy to implement here in Tahoe. And so let me be clear on what decision is coming to you. It was at that point 5 years ago, we realized we can't get to a final remedy without the information that the public urged and without the information that was required by the regulatory process. So the proposal coming to you next month is not going to be a final remedy. It's going to be a proposal to perform a carefully controlled test of different treatment options on a small but representative scale to help all of us close information gaps and address public fears about the effects of all these different kinds of treatments. And the homeowners and the stakeholders collaboratively chose this route so that we could begin to find a shared approach, if possible, to what has become a very complex and often confusing regulatory scheme. So when we churn with indecision and uncertainty on these really, really important and contentious environmental issues, what has become clear to us is that no one wins and nothing improves. And what we know from decades of experience is that to solve some of our lake's toughest, most insoluble problems, it often takes a much more collaborative approach for us to reach a solution. So it was about 5 years ago, we started to see the problem differently. We started to see it in its bigger context as a lake-wide threat. And it wasn't merely a problem for a group of private property owners, but it had become more of a systemic problem, a collective problem, if you will. It was the whole lake's problem. So that shift in mindset allowed us to begin to stand together in common interest to protect not just the Keys, but the lake, its ecosystem, and what we know is Tahoe's $5 billion economy, rather than just continuing to stare across the proverbial kind of us and them divide where kind of any and all progress tends to stall. By 2018, we began working with the Keys property owners and other key stakeholders to define a different path. And so we convened a stakeholder committee and an even broader steering committee and a far more collaborative approach where we engaged the private property owners with the agencies, with key stakeholders, with the public, and we set out to secure funding to help seek a more supported solution. So over the last 4 years alone, we've now partnered with the Keys owners and we've contributed over $2 million. We've shared with the Property Owners Association in the cost of a facilitator mediator to help us work with stakeholders in the public. We've funded some of the technical studies. We've funded the EIS that we're reviewing today. And we're sharing in the costs of some of these different interim treatment methods to gather what has become really valuable data for us. So we went that route of shared problem solving because our experience proves progress in Tahoe happens only at the speed of trust. So after 50 years of failed attempts, as more time passes and the clock ticks and we don't have a clear solution at hand, this problem is now finding far more favorable conditions due to our changing climate. So now that the infestation has spread and taken hold just outside the Keys, there is the real possibility that without focused and effective action, the problem may simply just get away from us, and we're going to have an entirely different, even more dire, far broader and far more systemic problem, a problem of far more public concern for the lake. So when the stakeholders came together to ask ourselves, how do we move ahead? It was clear we had to lessen the unknowns and the fears of broad-scale treatment before moving to a full remedy. So we sat at the table together. We agreed to study a proposal to test different weed control methods. And what we needed to know was, you know, pretty basic. What control methods, if taken independently or in combination, could lead to a potentially effective result in knocking back the population and then maintaining it? And what methods would have negative effects on the environment? So together, TKPOA agency stakeholders designed this combination of tests that could help us answer those information gaps. So now by proposing a scientifically valid test of each of the known treatment methods, both separately and in combination in this very variable environment of the Keys, we're going to be able to fill data gaps and gaps in our knowledge about performance of these different methods that plagued that first proposed plan by TKPOA back in 2017. So this is necessary information that can help us later to design and decide when we get to the much harder decision of what should the comprehensive solution in the Keys Lagoons be. We've provided this board and the public with the final stakeholder committee report that summarizes the past several years of work that we did together and concludes that the test design was developed in an open, transparent, responsive design process, and that EIS evaluation of the proposed tests is both scientifically complete, scientifically valid, and robust. So today we're going to be looking only at the proposed test of these different methods and not the effects of some larger solution that will come later after the tests give us good information about the possible environmental effects of each of these methods and the likely efficacy of those methods singularly and in combination in the environment of the Keys. So with that, thank you for indulging this kind of very high level context. I'm going to turn this to Dennis, who will walk us through the rest of this. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Good snowy morning, everyone. Mr. Chair, members of the board and the public, I'm Dennis Abaglo. I'm the Aquatic Resources Program Manager for the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, and I oversee the Aquatic Invasive Species Program here in Lake Tahoe. And I'm not afraid to say a program I think we're all very proud of. The success we've achieved not only with prevention in the boat inspection program, but with monitoring and control, which is what we'll talk about here today, specifically with the Tahoe Keys Lagoons aquatic weeds control methods test and providing you an overview and bring you up to speed on where we are in the process. So I'll start by describing the challenge and the urgency. You heard Joanne key in on that already, the challenge and the urgency the Keys presents. I'll highlight all the hard work and coordination and collaboration that's happened over the last 3.5 years that really has gotten us to this point. And then I'll turn it over to Rick Lind. He's with SEA and represents the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association, or TKPOA. He'll provide some context on the history of weed management within the Keys over the last several years. And then Dr. Lars Anderson, also representing TKPOA, will provide some context and some details of the proposed test project itself. And then Jim Good with Environmental Science Associates. He's our lead technical team, led the science effort on doing the impact analysis, and he'll review the results of the draft analysis. And then I'll provide a summary and turn it over to, back to the board for any questions that you might have. So this story really kind of starts out with the boat inspection program. The success we had there, essentially shutting the door on new invasive species from coming into Lake Tahoe, gave us the confidence to tackle the existing species we had prior to the boat inspection program going into place. Looking at those two species of crudleaf pondweed and Eurasian water milfoil, two notorious invaders throughout the country, so we're not really unique to that, but they really have a big threat to Lake Tahoe, threatening that famed clarity that we all enjoy, and what we're famous for, but also our unique environment and ecosystem, and that $5 billion recreation-based economy Joanne mentioned. And specifically with crudleaf pondweed, that presents additional fears for us as it has a greater ability to live out into Lake Tahoe proper. And so looking at those invasive species we had, starting at small scale projects on the around the lake, doing control projects, building our lessons learned, if you will, getting success, achieving localized eradication in many locations around the lake, and now focusing on some of our bigger infestations and addressing our number one priority for control for the AIS program, and that's the Tahoe Keys. It's a different animal. It's huge, over 170 acres. 30 times larger than any treatment project we've completed to date, and then also very difficult conditions within to treat. It's large, dense populations, almost 100% infested throughout those waterways, but also murky water, poor visibility, and a loose organic muck layer, if you will, at the bottom that really makes treatment within the Keys difficult. And with all that, finding solutions really demand a hard look at all of the options that we have available to us, and that includes controversial methods as well. The Keys is the primary source of spread for the rest of the lake, so it's a major threat. And so the infestation now directly outside the Keys in the area we refer to the Tahoe Keys Complex is over 100 acres, so the time is now to really start moving forward with finding solutions in a test, and then ultimately being able to understand the long-term strategy of treatment in the Keys. And really, our ability to achieve our lake-wide goals in aquatic invasive weed reduction hinges on our ability to be successful in the Tahoe Keys. So as Joanne mentioned, the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association submitted an application to both TRPA and Lahontan, and that to address the infestation of aquatic weeds within the waterways. And that proposal did include the use of herbicides. So the herbicides being controversial, the Keys itself being just a polarizing subject, and that complexity we described really needed a broad set of eyes looking at the issue we're facing. And that's started with a collaborative process, similar to the Shoreline Program. Stakeholder committee and a collaborative process was put in place, had a successful program there. And so we want to mimic that success and bring in a stakeholder committee that can provide that lake-wide perspective for a lake-wide problem, truly. And so that stakeholder committee consists of TRPA and Lahontan as lead agencies, and also TKPOA as the project proponent, but also different perspectives with the Tahoe Water Suppliers Association that provide drinking water throughout the region, the League to Save Lake Tahoe, the environmental nonprofit organization, and the Tahoe Resource Conservation District, our primary partner in the AIS program, who has local expertise on treating invasive aquatic plants within the lake. So that stakeholder committee really provides the transparency necessary for a complex project such as this and provide those diverse perspectives. And the initial outcome of that stakeholder committee was that we're dealing with a different animal, as I said, and we really need to know more information. And how do you do that? And that really starts with a test of multiple methods of control to find what will provide that long-term solution for the long term. So we're starting with a test is what was recommended when moving forward with that. And a test is really, you know, that opportunity to balance that fine line of the urgency, but also making sure we get it right. And as Webster describes a test, it's to take measures to check the quality, performance, or reliability of something, especially before putting it into widespread use or practice. And that's what we're trying to do here. So what does the test project look like? With the input from the stakeholder committee and the property owners, the test project looks at those multiple methods of control in initial knockback, as Joanne mentioned, in standalone and combination approaches, looking at what we refer to as group A methodologies that can provide that initial knockback of weeds in a first year of a test. So those group A methods include ultraviolet light or UV light, or you might hear it referred to as UVC light as well. The C is the bandwidth of the ultraviolet light, along with targeted aquatic herbicides and laminar flow aeration, which is another innovative approach that provides consistent oxygen from the top to the bottom that helps reduce that muck layer, as I mentioned, making it less suitable for weeds to grow. But looking at those independently and in combination, and then to get that knockback, and then in years two and beyond, having these other methods that are able to maintain the infestation at a manageable level. So what we refer to as group B methods. So ultraviolet light can be used in that capacity as well, but then incorporating some more of those traditional methods we have here in Tahoe with bottom barriers that block sunlight from the plants that they need, and diver hand pulling and diver assisted suction. And that would be done over the course of multiple years after that first year of initial knockback. So the goal of the test is to achieve a 75% reduction in biomass. And really the ultimate goal is to find out what combination of approaches that can achieve that 75% biomass and then could be upscaled in a phase two, if you will, a few years down the road after the test is completed and efficacy is understood. So this is an example of how a combination approach might work. This would have ultraviolet light being used in the middle of a channel or a finger of the keys, deeper areas of the lake that the boat can just move through pretty readily, and then potentially the use of herbicides along the edges where there's lots of docks, trees, and other impediments that might prevent the UV boat, the ultraviolet light boat, from gaining access. So maximizing the efficacy of both treatments to understand if that can give us the best result down the road. And we took the opportunity this past summer to increase our understanding of ultraviolet light ability within the Keys. We've used it at small scales with promising results in other areas of the lake, but never in the conditions like the Tahoe Keys. And so trials within the Keys expanded by 400% over other areas of the lake, looking at the different water quality conditions in the Keys. Low water levels were certainly a concern this year, and looking at ways to making sure we can maximize the use to implement that technique effectively in the test program. So once that proposed test project was developed with a combination of approaches. An independent technical team was brought in with expertise in aquatic systems to do the environmental impact analysis and to develop the environmental documents the two lead agencies need to make decisions on this test project proposal. And that process started with a scoping period. Back in 2019, the scoping period was opened that allowed the public the opportunity to weigh in on the test project, and then also weigh in on what alternatives should be considered in this environmental review process. And that public scoping resulted in two additional action alternatives in addition to the proposed test project that looked at an alternative that did not include all of the tools, so we would remove the use of herbicides, so only looking at non-herbicidal methods in a test, and then a dredging alternative. We got a lot of feedback from the public about some sort of physical manipulation should be considered, and a dredging alternative would potentially remove some of that substrate, the weeds, and the roots themselves. And so all of those were analyzed in addition to a no-project alternative. It's a required element of any environmental analysis process, but a little bit unique here in the sense that usually a no-project alternative does not have the in-depth review that other projects might have. And so a no-project alternative really means that no test is done, nothing is learned, and that just allows weeds to continue to grow and spread, threatening Lake Tahoe at large. So in the summer of 2020, that draft analysis was completed. It consisted of a comprehensive and scientific analysis of the different treatment methods, identifying potential impacts that may result of those methodologies. And it really reflects the complexity and strict environmental standards we have here at Lake Tahoe. That public review period was extended beyond the normal requirement to include a 60-day public comment period. And because of the complexity and the need to have all of those eyes and input, as we've mentioned today, we took every opportunity to allow the public to provide additional engagement or to have additional engagement more so than a normal process. And so having multiple public workshops and seminars and webinars, in addition to the hearings around the draft that the public could weigh in and provide their input, but also development of the website that has all of the information for the public to access it at any time. And that's updated regularly. And then we also conducted several field tours to get a firsthand eyewitness, if you will, of what the infestation looked like. And I know many of you on the board were able to participate in some of those in 2019 to really get that firsthand look at the infestation. It's really important. So that public engagement process resulted in about 3,000 comments, all weighing in on different aspects of the test, on the impact analysis. And so the two agencies have been diligently responding to those comments and preparing the final environmental analysis that it will be available at the end of the month. And in addition to that public engagement, we engaged our science community. The Tahoe Science Advisory Council provided input that the test approach was a logical course to address this complicated problem. But also that the analysis was thorough and comprehensive. So some highlights before we turn it over to our next speakers. The environmental analysis that was conducted, really a lot of data was collected as well to help understand the dynamics within the Keys, providing those information gaps, or at least the start of the information gaps, understanding the dynamics, as I mentioned, within the Keys, and really what drives weeds and nutrients within the Keys is the weeds themselves. The annual growth and dieback, as the weeds die, they just release those nutrients back into the water and the sediment that is then available for them to use as they grow year over year. So it's just a perpetual cycle of releasing nutrients back into the system. And so the best way to remove the nutrient and break that cycle is to treat the weeds themselves. And one of the major outcomes of that analysis is that with proper mitigations and resource protective measures, a test can be implemented safely. And really, as I mentioned, a no-project alternative analysis that really has never been done before at this level is the only alternative that resulted in significant and unavoidable impacts. And that's due to the rampant growth and spread that would occur if nothing is done. And just to provide a little bit of regulatory framework and considerations for the two agencies, TRPA and Lahontan, both proposed projects would require a permit from the agencies if it's approved, with Lahontan issuing a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, or NPDS permit, as you may know it, if the test project is approved. And a tentative or draft permit was made available to the public earlier this in November that also included a public comment period. TRPA, if approved, would need to issue an environmental improvement program permit for the test program. And the considerations for Lahontan, does the project comply with the basin plan? And considering the special status Tahoe has as an outstanding national resource water, can a test project meet those anti-degradation requirements? And then for TRPA, is the project consistent with the regional plan? And we'll be coming back to you next month with those draft permits and the final analysis in order to make those decisions. And so now I'll turn it over to Rick Lind from TKPUA and Sierra Ecosystems Associates to provide some history on weed management within the Keys. Rick.
Thank you, Dennis. Mr. Chair, members of the board, my name is Rick Lind. I am with the Tahoe Keys Association Water Quality Committee, and I am also president of Sierra Ecosystem Associates. And Dennis, if we can bring the slides up. Thank you. Yeah, since about 2013, SCA, along with Dr. Lars Anderson, have been supporting the Tahoe Keys Association with identifying and evaluating the full range of options that might be successful in trying to bring the aquatic invasive species under control. What I'd like to do in the next few minutes is give you a brief history of the aquatic weed management efforts in the Keys, describe a little bit more about the regulatory basis that is driving our evaluations and permit, give you a summary of the past decade, in particular of data collection and studies, because they have been extensive. And after that, I'll be turning it over to Dr. Lars Anderson, who will be describing the scope of the CMT project, its strategies, and also some of the detailed components of the monitoring program. Next slide. First of all, the Tahoe Keys weeds management efforts have been going on for a very long time. Started back in the 1970s when the Tahoe Keys built a water circulation and treatment system that was targeting the reduction of nutrients in the water that at the time and still today we believe are contributing to the expansion of the aquatic invasive plant growth. Since that time, there have been a number of intermittent efforts, both mechanical and otherwise, to try to evaluate ways in which at that time, the Eurasian water milfoil could possibly be brought under control. In 2003, and I'm not sure if anyone's mentioned it yet, but it's been really quite recently that curly leaf pondweed first appeared in the Tahoe Keys lagoons. And since that time, just really within the past two decades, curly leaf pondweed has become the number one aquatic invasive plant in the lagoons, even overtaking Eurasian water milfoil. Next. The last decade of efforts by the Tahoe Keys has been driven by a regulatory trigger that was issued by Lahontan in 2014. At that time, they issued a waste discharge requirements permit, which required the Tahoe Keys to develop an integrated management plan to look at both the waterside and landside of activities that might be contributing to the aquatic weed problem. Associated with that were annual, or have been annual, requirements for surveys of weeds in the lagoons, for monitoring stormwater runoff, and also for looking at alternative methods that could bring the weeds under control. Next. One of the primary requirements of the waste discharge requirements permit was that preparation of an integrated management plan, which has very specific objectives identified. First of all, the IMP is being developed to minimize the spread of aquatic invasive weeds out of the lagoons. It's also targeting the enhancement of native habitats within the lagoons, looking for ways to improve those habitats, while simultaneously reducing non-native habitat for example, invasive fish. And lastly, restoring recreational uses as well as the institutional and commercial uses of the Marina Lagoon. Next slide. The past decade of studies and efforts, and I like to touch on this because I think this effort in 2011 really started or initiated the collaborative effort between the Tahoe Keys, TRPA, and the Tahoe RCD. At that time in 2011, TRPA funded an extensive worldwide literature search to look for alternative methods that could be considered for bringing the weeds under control. Since that time, we have been collecting annually a wide variety of water quality, plant infestation, other contributing factors such as atmospheric emissions, looking really at the context within which these weeds might be brought under control. Next slide. In addition to the extensive data collection efforts, the Tahoe Keys also convened in 2014 an expert panel of individuals that are recognized throughout the U.S. as the top experts in aquatic invasive weed management. Those included our local experts as well as experts from back east, where the problem has been ongoing for really much longer even than we see here out west. One of the outcomes of that was a report by the expert panel, which was presented to the public in 2015, which then triggered a series of meetings, which then led to what Joanne mentioned earlier as the first Tahoe Keys application to perform the control methods test, and that was applied for in 2017. Next slide. In addition to the data collection and the expert panel, the Tahoe Keys Association has also instituted a number of cultural practices as well as changes in the methods and the approaches for managing fragments and the weeds within the lagoons. And that includes working with the League to Save Lake Tahoe on implementing a boat backup station, as well as installing bubble curtains at the West Channel to try to minimize the movement of fragments out of the lagoons into the lake proper. And in addition, the Tahoe Keys Association has expended considerable funds on new technology boats, such as the Omnicat Skimmer, which basically travels throughout the lagoons on a nonstop basis during the weed growing season, collecting fragments off the surface of the lagoons. Next slide. One of the most concerning findings of the annual surveys required by the Waste Discharge Requirements Permit has been the documented increase in growth of the curly leaf pondweed. Whereas back in 2014-15 even, curly leaf pondweed represented only a very small fraction of the invasive plants in the lagoons. Today, it is now the dominant plant in the lagoons, even overtaking Eurasian water milfoil, which has been around since the 1970s. Next slide. What is even more concerning is what Dennis showed earlier in this slide, which is where the Tahoe Resource Conservation District in the past 2 years has documented the spread of dense infestations of curly leaf pondweed along with Eurasian water milfoil out into the lake proper. This area here represents about 100 acres within which the TRCD survey documented a large number of dense patches of both invasive plants. Next slide. So that has led us to the proposed control methods test, which we believe is urgent, as has been mentioned in prior discussions. And because of the growth and the exponential rate at which the plant, in particular curly leaf pondweed, has shown its pattern, we feel that the time is right, it's not too soon to go out and review and test side by side all potential methods that may be successful in bringing the aquatic invasive plants under control. If approved in January, as currently scheduled, the Tahoe Keys Association, along with the collaborators, would be implementing the control methods test in May of next year for a 3-year period. And what I'd like to do now is to turn it over to Dr. Lars Anderson to talk about the scope, the strategy, and some of the specific components of the monitoring program for the control methods test. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. This is Lars Anderson. I've been working with the Tahoe Keys organization for the last 10 to 15 years. And just as a little background, not too many years ago, I retired from my 40-year career with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, running a lab on the UC Davis campus, and that was completely focused on the biology and management of aquatic plants, such as the ones at Lake Tahoe. So I have a strong feeling of the need for this project, and I would like to delve into a little more detail as we proceed. Next slide, please. So I'll cover some of the strategy and the context for the proposed methods that we're wanting to use, talk a little bit about the specific treatments and about the monitoring components of the CNT, and then close with a timeline of where we are right now and what's ahead of the next few months. Next slide. Most important thing I think to consider, if I have the next click there, Dennis, is that it's a 3-year program. In the first year, the strategy is to knock down the biomass in the spring, keep the spring growth from continuing, in other words, arrest that spring growth of the plants. And as I think as Dennis has mentioned, and Rick, clearly pondweed produces treonth. I'll show you this in just a minute. If we can stop those from being formed, we can actually slow down the spread of that plant into Lake Tahoe, as well as the spread within the Tahoe Keys. Next, click on there. Dennis, can you? Thank you. So the first year of the program is the only year in which the aquatic herbicides are proposed to be used, and they would be used alone or in combination with some of the treatments. And Dennis mentioned UVC light treatments, glomerular flow aeration, and herbicide and anti-herbicide combination. So only in the first year would the herbicide be used in our proposal. The subsequent years, years 2 and 3, you can show the next click on there, only non-herbicide methods or group B methods would be used, and those include diver removal, continued use of UVC operations and exposure and bottom barriers where it can. The third year is pretty much the same. The whole idea of this approach is to knock down the plants in the first year, sustain control in the second and third year as well. Now, at the bottom of the slide, it also shows that the environmental monitoring continues from the beginning of the program all the way out to 3 years, which includes looking at herbicide levels, water quality, non-target organisms impact as well. And I'll talk a little bit more about those in detail in just a minute. Next slide. You know, we've already talked about the scale of the problem in the lagoons, and I wanted to sort of illustrate this, showing an overview of the Tahoe Keys lagoons. That area that is outlined and bordered in yellow represents the total area of all the other marinas in Lake Tahoe. So I think as Joanne pointed out, and Dennis has mentioned, this is a very complex system, much larger, much more impacted by the plants of the other sites. But it's also more complex because it has different conditions within it. The substrate or the bottom conditions are different. The flows are different within the system. And of course, you have a whole complex of the plants and native plants. And I should mention too, that's important because part of the CNT is to look at the effects of our treatment types on desirable native plants in the system. I also should also mention, if you look at that diagram, typically in the spring, water is coming from the Lake Tahoe itself and fills the lagoons. This actually stabilizes water in the lagoons and tends to prevent things from moving out into the lake in the early spring to midsummer. Next slide. Thanks. Just a summary of the goals. Again, you've heard some of these already, certainly reducing the plant populations and infestations to protect the lake. We want to look at methods that are feasible and environmentally safe. We want to establish the conditions and the keys in the habitats that are favorable to native plants and fish. Also support navigation, recreation, and aesthetic uses in that system. We certainly want to have methods that prevent reinfestation after you go to a lot of trouble to reduce a plant population. You really want to make sure that it maintains in that control mode. And lastly, the data that we gather from this study will help inform and help us decide what kinds of approaches could be effective later on. And basically what we're trying to do is get that information and the data together in a way that's, that we can count on to help develop these methods in the future. Next slide. Thanks. We are using specific metrics. I think Dennis already mentioned that our goal is to reduce the biomass or bulk of the plants in there by 75%. And I should mention the rationale for this is that that typically is the level of which you can maintain populations that are there, but also reduce the impacts of those plants. In this case, that also includes the impacts of moving those plants from the Keys into Lake Tahoe by various modes. And sometimes the boats do this, but also waterfowl can move these. You can have storm events and different flows that can move those fragments of plants out there. And then lastly, as I mentioned, we want to make sure that we have methods that will help increase the desirability of the native plants and their occurrence within the Keys. I should point out at this point, most of those native plants are less than 5 to 10% of the total plants that are in the Keys. The native invasive plants are currently out competing those native plants in the Keys. Next slide. Thanks. Just to give you an idea of why we're focusing on the spring period and why it's important, this is an example in 2018 of the coverage of aquatic plants in the Keys. That blue area simply means that there's almost no plants in there. This was done with the hydroacoustic scan. It's kind of like a very high-valued, high-intensity fish finder system. It allows us to look at the plant cover and how much are there. And so if you look at that blue area, that means there's very few plants. And just the next slide shows in July of the same year. And by July of the same year, you've got almost 100% coverage in all the coves. And that means that in that three-month period or so, June, July, so May to June, you've increased your biomass by hundreds of a percent. And the only blue areas are there, by the way, just south of the West Channel are because those waters are about 20 to 25 feet deep in there, and the rest are not. So this is the thing we're trying to prevent. We don't want to go from the typical April condition to this condition if these methods are successful. Next slide, Dennis. Dennis? Thanks. So we've all talked about curly leaf pondweed. I did want to show you why this plant is so has such capacity to spread and to become a nuisance plant in systems. Even though it does make seed, the seed typically don't sprout for years. Mostly what this plant does during the spring and midsummer is produce a lot of these structures called turions. You can see that in the upper right picture. Every shoot on the plant produces dozens of those turions, and so you start adding up the shoot, and you can understand that by the time you're in the midsummer, there are thousands of these turions being produced, not only in the Keys, but also in some populations offshore in South Lake Tahoe. And those turions, each turion is capable of producing a new plant in the spring. In fact, they start sprouting in late summer to fall in some occasions. So you really have this head start of this invasive plant for the next year. So the key is if you could stop the plant from making those turions, you're going a long way toward the strategy of reducing the impact of the plant the next year and reducing your population altogether. Next slide. So I think Dennis mentioned that the concern we have with nutrients in the Keys. And this sort of a diagram or cartoon shows what happens in the spring when you have small plants. They begin to take nutrients from the sediment and allocate them to their shoots and the leaves. And so if you click a couple of clicks there, Dennis, the nitrogen and phosphorus winds up into the plant tissues. And then when those plants, even during the summer, they're leaking out nitrogen and phosphorus from the plants. But when they start to senesce and break down in the fall, those nutrients go right back in the water column and wind up right back into the sediment as the plants decay on the bottom. So you have this cycle. It's almost like a positive feedback cycle, regenerating nutrients so the plants can sprout again next year and have plenty of nutrients to grow on. So again, that's part of the strategy is to stop that cycle. Next slide. So currently, as you're aware, probably for the last 40 years, the primary mechanism for controlling the plants has been harvesting. Mechanically cutting the plants, this does two things. It does remove a lot of biomass in the upper surface of the water, but it also produces thousands and thousands of fragments. You can see the cutter on the left, the harvester, got plant scraping off of it. TKPOA staff does a lot of work to control those fragments, including what's already been mentioned, the bubble curtains and skimmer boats, but you can't collect them all, and it's just overwhelming at times. And if you look at that bulk of plants on the right-hand side, you can see there's a lot that come out of there, but these plants are so prolific and grow so fast that you actually stimulate their growth when you start cutting them this way. And so we're really trying to, the strategy here is to develop a program that reduces the need for harvesting, that's much more effective than this, and reduces those fragments to get out into Lake Tahoe proper. Next slide. So in summarizing the test we've been talking about, on the left-hand side, you'll see year one. Again, it's group A methods, very specific and very specific sites. I'll show you those sites in just a minute. We have combination treatments and standalone treatments. Those will be evaluated for the effectiveness of each treatment, and the results of those will be help us decide what to do in the future. The second and third years on the right-hand side of that table show that the group B methods are being used to sustain that control. Those do not include any herbicide methods, but all the other methods that we have identified as potential for keeping these plants under control once they're reduced in the first year. So that's a critical component, is to get this strategy in place and then determine if we can use these other methods, group B methods, to sustain that management. Next slide. Thanks. So just for a brief minute, I wanted to show you some of these specific sites that we're talking about. We proposed, it's important. First of all, we have replicated treatment, so the scientific integrity of this project is really high. You have to have triplicate sets of sites in order to do the statistics that you need to show there's differences or there are not differences. I've circled in blue the UVC herbicide combinations, and Dennis showed you that shot of the cove where the UV light goes down the middle and the herbicides are only applied on the outside. What's really good about that potential, if it does work, if you look on the right-hand side in the green box, it shows that the total acreage required for herbicides there is less than half. That's because you're only treating that zone from the boat dock toward the shore and not the middle part of those coves. So that's an important component of these tests. We also have control sites where we don't do any treatment except the standard harvesting that's been going on for 40 years. And that way we can compare these together. And I should mention it's important that this project take place in a single year. And as we all know, we've seen it last year and several years, the lake levels changed, the conditions in the Keys changed. So we need to apply these methods and do a head-to-head comparison in the same year so we have the same kind of conditions out there. But if you look in the lower right half of the table, you'll see that the total of 16.9 acres only that are being proposed for herbicide application out of a total of 172 acres. So it's a relatively small part of that. Next slide. I mentioned the monitoring program. This identifies some of the key components of the monitoring program that will go on from the beginning of the CMT until the end. And some of these have already started because they're standard water quality measurements that the TKPOA has been doing for many years. But this includes looking at the effectiveness on the target plants that we've been talking about, the effectiveness or impacts on non-target plants and organisms as well, looking at the water quality components, DO, pH, those things that are standard water quality components, specifically looking at herbicide levels and the degradants within the water column on a very regular basis from the day they're introduced until the degradation occurs and they're no longer detectable, looking at cyanobacteria, and TKPOA, the Keys folks have been looking at this for many years, but we're interested to see if there's any influence of the cyanobacteria on these treatments. The benthic macroinvertebrates are really important to determine if there's any impact on organisms that live in the bottom. And there is kind of a mucky bottom, but there's things that live there, and we want to make sure we're not impacting those. Those will be sampled. I mentioned the rhodamine WT dye that's listed in this circle. This is really an interesting approach because we can apply this dye at the same time that we apply herbicides there, and immediately on a real-time basis determine where that dye moves, and it sort of mimics or it's a surrogate for the movement of those herbicides. So it tells us right away if we've got them in the right place, of course we would want to, and what their movement might be. So it's a very good way to get a handle on the assessment of herbicide application. And lastly, all these components of the monitoring and data collection are done with quality assurance and quality control, so we have a high integrity of our results at the end of the 3 years. Next slide. Thanks. I wanted to point out one of the key mitigation measures within the CMT, and that is the installation of 6 double curtain barriers at these sites that are located on this image with the white arrows. Those will be installed before herbicides are applied, and they separate the herbicide areas toward the south, as you can see where they are, from the rest of the main lagoon and also certainly from Lake Tahoe. And those herbicides will be left in place for about 21 days. We have no detect around them. But in addition to that, we will be monitoring water quality and levels of herbicides within the treatment areas, just outside the treatment areas, and even in the lagoon spaces in that large area that's outside the curtains. And if there's any detection in those areas, we'll move to another set of contingency sampling sites, which is shown on the next slide along the shore. Thanks. So these are the tracks that we propose as contingency sampling if we do see any residues within the keys south of the channel. And so those are the areas that would be sampled following that. Next slide. So just as a reminder, the strategy is to knock down the plants in the spring, stop spring growth in the first year and the only year in which herbicides are proposed to be used. In years 2 and 3, we sustain this control with our non-herbicide methods. And at the same time, we're looking at these monitoring approaches. So we know what the impacts are of the methods that we're testing, both in terms of the efficacy and effectiveness on the target plants, but also on the non-target and desirable organisms within the keys themselves. Next slide is time frame, and this shows the process. And I think, you know, actually Rick has talked a little bit about the previous months, what's been happening. We're now into January, soon to be in December, in January for decision making. But the key here is that if the permit is issued, if you look on the right hand side, you'll see that our first proposed part of treatments for the CMT would be early May. And again, the reason for that is to prevent those plants from growing and to utilize that time when water is coming into the keys, therefore keeping materials in the keys with a very little likelihood of anything moving out of the keys in addition to the barriers that we have there. So I think I'll turn it back at this point over to Jim, who's going to continue some discussions on the EIS. Is that right, Jim?
Yes, good afternoon. This is Jim Good. I'm with Environmental Science Associates, and I'm part of that independent consultant team that TRPA brought in to take a look at potential environmental issues of the project. So our job was to think about what could go wrong with this testing of weed control methods that Lars has described, and identify potential issues, look at the resource protection measures that were incorporated in the way TKPOA proposes to implement the testing, and think about what additional mitigation measures might be necessary to be sure that environmental impacts are less than significant. So we started this process it was over 4 years ago with an environmental study and environmental checklist. We reviewed information that had already been collected by TKPOA and other researchers, and We identified potential issues. We determined that an EIS and EIR would be necessary for a project like this to go forward. And we identified data gaps or uncertainties where we didn't really have enough information to determine if environmental effects might be significant. So that led to a 2019 baseline study where we collected a lot of in-depth information on the function of the Tahoe Keys lagoons. So they are a pretty complex ecosystem that has interactions between physical, chemical, and biological components. And so we had an in-depth study that collected over 1.5 million data points. And this went all through the growing season of 6 months in 2019. So we had a team of 5 PhD specialists that were evaluating the aquatic impacts, and that included environmental toxicologists, a limnologist or a lake ecology specialist, an aquatic plant specialist, fisheries biologist, and a hydrologist. One of the concerns was what could happen with the nutrient cycling that was described by Lars. And so we developed a conceptual model of the nutrient loading and nutrient cycling so we could understand the magnitude of the different sources and how the phosphorus and nitrogen move through the system. So in the environmental impact statement and EIR, there were 43 issues that were identified and evaluated. So most of these issues were in the lagoons where the activities of the weed control testing will take place. We identified environmental health issues, both for people and aquatic life, issue with hydrology, and a number of potential issues with water quality and aquatic ecology. And in addition, TRC evaluated some of the other resources like air quality and recreation and traffic and transportation and so on. But what we found was that except for the no action or the no project alternative, the impacts can be mitigated to be less than significant for each of these 43 issues. Next slide, please. So for the control methods test, the proposed project, there were resource protection measures built into the way those tests would be conducted that addressed many of the issues. But we identified 10 issues where there could be potentially significant effects without mitigation. So first of those was exposure and health risks to the workers that were applying herbicides. And the potential for detectable concentrations of herbicide chemicals to persist in the lagoon water. There are high levels of aluminum in the sediments in the lagoons that have been there for a long time, and there's a potential for short-term increases of aluminum in the water, which can be harmful to fish and other aquatic life. We were definitely concerned about the potential to increase harmful algal blooms. So the cyanobacteria and the potential for them to produce toxins is a problem that's been present in the lagoons without this project. We just need to be sure that that problem is not going to get worse during the course of testing weed control methods. There's several water quality issues that could occur with the dieback and the decay of aquatic plants. So oxygen depletion, the release of phosphorus and nitrogen into the lagoon water where it can stimulate the algal blooms. And then also ecological effects, the impacts to non-target aquatic plants, including sensitive species and subsequent changes to aquatic plant communities. So these were the 10 issues where, with a control methods test, additional mitigation would be needed to reduce the impacts to being less than significant. But we were able to develop mitigation measures where we're confident that it would be less than significant. So getting into the mitigation methods here, for herbicides, there's a lot of training and licensing that's required for the workers applying the chemicals. The proposed application rates would be a lot lower than the approved label rates for these chemical products. And with the chemical breakdown and other resource protection measures, there's less than a significant risk that any of those detectable chemicals would persist longer than 1 to 3 weeks. There would be spill prevention and response plan requirements to be sure that there weren't excess concentrations of herbicides that found their way into the lagoons. And aeration could be used if needed to accelerate the aerobic degradation of herbicides. So if the monitoring of the herbicides after application finds that they're not breaking down as quickly as expected, aeration is something that could accelerate that aerobic degradation. The best management practices that are common to minimize sediment disturbance would also be effective in mitigating this potential for aluminum to leave the sediments and enter the water. And with the phosphorus and nitrogen and the potential for harmful algal blooms, the timing and the limited size of treatments minimize the amount of plant tissue that's decomposing in the lagoon. And lanthanum modified clay is a product that could be used if needed to remove phosphorus from the lagoon water. So it essentially strips this essential nutrient out of the water and starves the algae. And again, if aeration were needed, that would make conditions less favorable for the harmful algal blooms. With respect to dissolved oxygen, again, the timing and limited size of treatments minimizes the amount of decomposing plant tissue, and aeration could be used if the real-time monitoring of dissolved oxygen indicates that it's needed. Part of the design of the test is to have spring macrophyte surveys to adjust the test site boundaries. So this would be sure that we're concentrating on the target species and avoiding impacts to non-target plants and effects on the overall aquatic plant community composition. Go ahead, Dennis. So looking at alternative one, and again, this is the alternative where all of the tests would go forward except herbicides would not be used as a group A method. Most of the potentially significant issues and mitigation are the same as what I've already covered for the proposed project, but of course, the issue of worker exposure and persistence of herbicide chemicals in the water would go away. Next slide. Alternative two, the potentially significant impacts and mitigations are pretty different from the other alternatives. This is the alternative where the only group A method being tested would be the dredging, hydraulic dredging and replacement of substrate. So there'd be a much greater risk from aluminum in the sediments. And that drives the need for more mitigation there. So it'd be very important to have spill prevention during the transport and handling of the dredge spoils. There's a lot of water that gets entrained with the hydraulic dredging systems. And so dewatering is a big challenge that would go with that. And all of the water it comes from the dewatering process would have to be treated and then tested before it could be discharged. And at this site that would be handling the dewatering process, leak prevention, spill control, and containment plans would all be very important. And at the actual test sites, turbidity curtain barriers would be used to contain the turbid water that's generated during dredging. We looked at the potential for the discharge of dewatering effluent to increase potential for flooding. But if either the discharge was to the sanitary sewer system or the discharge to Lake Tulac occurred in the summer or the fall when the water levels are low, it really would not contribute to a risk in flooding. The turbidity controls, of course, would be very important for dredging and substrate replacement processes, as well as the dewatering process. And again, the timing and the limited size of treatments and the potential use of aeration would all help with the possible problem with dissolved oxygen depletion. Next slide. And then increases in phosphorus and nitrogen The effluent treatment of the dewatering would require phosphorus and nitrogen removal. And those turbidity controls would also limit the amount of nutrients coming into the water from the sediment. Same as the other alternatives, we'd have the spring macrophyte surveys to adjust test site boundaries and focus on those target plants so that the effects to, and then, you know, with respect to how might Lake Tillac and Pope Marsh be affected if you were discharging treated water, you'd need to do that when the water levels are low so that you effects on non-target riparian and wetland habitats would be minimal. Next slide. It was this no action alternative or the no project alternative where we really did find the greatest concern for significant impacts, water quality impacts that are happening that really would not be reduced any, include this short-term risk of aluminum increases during disturbance of sediments in the lagoons, the ongoing potential risks from harmful algal blooms, and there's a lot of long-term concerns about water quality if that aquatic invasive weed problem doesn't get controlled, and these include increased water temperatures, increased turbidity, which is reducing water clarity, more floating weed fragments, greater changes in pH, lower dissolved oxygen, and increased phosphorus and nitrogen cycling from the sediments into the water that contributes to those harmful algal blooms. The long-term impacts to aquatic ecology include the displacement of the native plant species with invasive species, shifting those aquatic plant communities, the reduced health of the benthic invertebrate community and the entire food web, increased risks to special status fish species and the native and recreationally important fish species, and increased spread of other aquatic invasive species. The other risks with not getting the weed problem under control include reduced quality of recreational boating in Lake Tahoe, long-term impacts in terms of meeting TRPA's recreation thresholds, and potentially long-term impacts to water supplies at Lake Tahoe. So that concludes my review of the EIR, EIS, and I'm going to turn it back to Dennis for a wrap-up.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate that. Tracy, are you showing slides now?
Sorry, Dennis. Yes, I am. I was muted. Apologies.
No worries. Thank you. So I just wanted to conclude with some summary statements here. I want to thank our presenters today for your patience as well, Governing Board. But as we've heard from all of us, a lot of work has gone in to getting us to where we are now. Extensive collaboration on a really complicated project and the development of a test project. The analysis and the test itself is a strong scientific foundation with the test design, use of technical experts in the analysis, and along with our advisors from academia, providing that science input with scientific rigor, not only with the test, but with the analysis. And that complexity and the urgency, you know, we have a balanced urgency here. So moving forward with the test to help us understand what that long-term solution might look like. But like we all said, that starts with the test. And so we have some important decisions on tap for next month. The final environmental analysis will be released at the end of the month with a Lahontan board decision on the certification of the environmental impact report and a decision on the tentative NPDES permit in the middle of January. And then the TRPA Advisory Planning Commission will be seeking a recommendation from them on certification of the EIS to the governing board. And then the governing board meeting in January at the end of the month to provide decisions on that certification and the test project. And if projects and certifications are approved, then implementation would commence in the spring of 2022. So thank you again for your time, and we will now turn it back to the board if there's any questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Dennis. I really appreciate it. I very much appreciate all the presenters, the experts, people who have spent so much time and thought, care with respect to this project. That goes without saying, it's incredibly important for our lake, for its health, and for its future. So thank you so much, Dennis, for coordinating all of this, and Joanne, Julie, John. This is an extraordinary issue that we're dealing with. So what I'd like to do right now is I would like to take 10 minutes between the conclusion of these presentations and the opportunity for board members to ask questions and give comments. If it's okay with everybody, it's 12:47. If we can be back at 12:57, I think that would be I think it would be a good spot to just take 10 minutes. Thank you. Okay, it's about 12:57, and just to get things going, John Friedrich has a couple of questions, I think, and maybe a comment. John?
Yeah. I guess we'll say Dennis is here at least. Dennis and all, thanks for a good comprehensive presentation. So I just want to start a couple questions. One is the Group A method knockback test. I see, you know, the goal is a 75% reduction in biomass. So my question is that the level deemed sufficient to stop spread of AIS from the Keys Lagoons by boats or to limit it?
That's the 75% is more or less a general standard of plant biomass reduction that would allow continuous Group B methodologies to be able to maintain a manageable infestation over the long term.
Right. So manageable as in, but I'm just wondering how it relates to spread by boats. And also, I guess a related question would be during the test, how will that level of knockback, assuming it's achieved and maintained, be assessed for limiting boat spread? In other words, if that level is achieved, will there be a monitoring to see if boats traveling through those test areas are not conveying AIS?
So the 75% knockback would be inclusive of any activities within the Keys after the test is complete, regardless of boats or natural spread and fragmentation of those plants. And then the second part of your question, I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Well, I mean, to the extent that, you know, beyond natural spread, that boats are conveying AIS throughout the lake, I mean, how in this test will the effectiveness of that knockback be evaluated in terms of stopping or limiting boat spread through those test areas?
So assuming a 75% reduction is achieved, that would help prevent additional spread because you have a reduced biomass and therefore less plants that boats could aid in that spread, but then also the best management practices, if you will, that are currently in place with bubble curtains and the boat backup station to prevent any continual spread from the Keys itself to the lake.
Okay, so there will be some evaluation then of the extent to which it's helping or to stop or eliminate boat spread. I mean, I think that would just be an important part of this, because that's if that's, you know, the assumption of effectiveness, right?
And yeah, the monitoring that would take place would include multiple aspects with hydroacoustic scanning, I think as Lars, Dr. Anderson portrayed, but use of divers and video footage of the treated areas to show or to demonstrate what type of back or reduction in biomass has been achieved.
And Dennis, this is John Marshall.
I just relate on.
One second. John Marshall's on.
John. I just wanted to add to that we do also do extensive monitoring around the lake. So that will also provide information as to whether or not spread outside of the Keys has been affected by the treatments within the Keys.
Okay. So that relates, I guess both of those comments relate to my next question, which is, as I understand it, if with a 3-year test here, essentially, next year would be the knockback group A methods, you know, years in 23 and 24 would be the group B maintenance method. So it wouldn't be until 2025 that the full Tahoe Keys Lagoon wide application of the selected group A method or methods would be applied, right? And so what is the plan to stop spread from the Keys Lagoon in the meantime by boats? I mean, I know there's the backup station, but it's not a mandatory backup station. It's used somewhat, but it's is there any consideration to, I mean, given the extent of this problem, to stop spread before the full method is applied, presumably after the test?
So the test is likely to take at least 3 years, up to 5 years. Okay. So with 2 to 4 years of follow-up Group B maintenance methods, as you mentioned, those boat backup station and bubble curtains are in place. The reporting from the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association shows that they're achieving increased compliance, if you will, with those systems year after year, with this last summer having about a 90% compliance of use of those backup stations and with the bubble curtains in place as well. But another aspect is the not just boats, but just the natural dynamics of the hydrology within the Keys itself. Water flows as we go later into the season, certainly under low water levels, just the natural flow allows or is also a contributor to fragments spreading out into the lake, not just the recreational watercraft.
Okay. There's not a specific plan for mitigating boat a spread during the 3 to 5 year test, right? It's kind of what is in place now being continued, not an amplification of those or a requirement, say that every boat must be in, go through the boat backup.
With the compliance rates that we're seeing right now, with 90%, that's a fairly high compliance rate. And with the additional monitoring John mentioned around the lake and the continuance of our rapid response actions, wherever they may occur, regardless of the source, to be able to address satellite populations if necessary.
Okay. And my final question is the cost of both the control test group A and B methods, and then the long-term maintenance plan, how is that being borne by TKPOA versus other funds? And is cost, and do you imagine cost will be a consideration in which ultimate method is applied over time?
So the test itself will help identify what the costs will be for the long term. We don't know that at this point. That's one of the reasons to conduct a test. TKPOA has property owner fees, as most homeowners agencies do, and they've also implemented a special assessment for this particular issue, and so they'll have significant funds that will be contributing to the test and whatever the long-term treatment ends up being.
Okay, actually, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, John, for those questions. I appreciate that. Next on the list is Shelley. Shelley, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mark. Thank you, Dennis. That was actually, it was very succinct when you consider the amount of time that has gone in to prepare you know, ultimately prepare the presentation we just heard. I mean, it's been a long kind of laborious process, but hopefully it will bear fruit. During Rick Lynn's presentation, there was a TRCD map. Can you bring that back up?
Tracy, can you bring up that map? It's probably midway through the entire presentation, maybe towards the first half, and it's a map that's got some orange and yellow highlights, or I can try to bring it up too, I suppose.
The area beyond the entrance to the Tahoe Keys. No, it's not that. It was illustrating the expansion of the, I believe it was the curly leaf pondweed into the lake proper.
Go a few more. Actually, I can go ahead and share my screen, Tracy. I have it up if you want to give me control. Tracy, can you give me control?
Should have control, Dennett. There you go.
Is that it there, Shelley?
Yeah, that's it. I was just interested in knowing what are the characteristics of the area that is not impacted. You've got a fairly substantial area of open water there that apparently has no infestation. And I was wondering what the characteristics of that area are and can they be duplicated?
This area, what we refer to as the Keys Complex,
Dennis, the colored area, there's an area of open water between 2 and 4 and 3.
Yes.
Right. I'm just curious. The substrate looks like what the characteristics of that area are that would make it inhospitable to infestation.
Whether or not it's truly inhospitable, I'm not sure if that would be the case, but a lot of this is due to boat traffic. You can see that the orange areas 1, 2, 5, and 6, that's where the boats are right. Leaving the Keys, with the areas adjacent to that kind of follows some boats as they leave the channel. But in general, that area has a sandy bottom, similar to other areas of the lake.
Interesting. Well, it seems to be kind of an anomaly. That's why I was curious.
So, that's an interesting observation, and that's something we can certainly have our divers go investigate further to see if there's any other differences that might help us understand.
Okay, and given the 90% level of compliance with respect to reversal of engines as boats are leaving the Keys, I'm assuming that the heavily infested areas are kind of accumulated infestation that's occurred over an extended period of time, right? So it doesn't accurately reflect the current measures that are in place that if they had been instituted earlier might have prevented this high density of infestation.
That's a fair assumption.
Okay.
That's and just on top of the bubble curtain and backup station that was put into place just a couple of years ago on the West Channel, a bubble mm-hmm. curtain has also been put in place on the East Channel as well just this past season.
Okay. The only other question I had, I know that, do you think, and this is kind of an unfair question, I suppose, that I'm assuming there's a correlation in the deeper areas of the Keys where there is less of an infestation. Is it due to the absence of light penetration to support the growth of the weeds? And if, in fact, that's the case, after the biomass is substantially eliminated or reduced, would dredging, do you think, be an effective maintenance option in the future to deepen the channels in those areas to prevent the reinfestation?
In the deepest areas of the Keys is that main lagoon in the right outside or right inside the West Channel, if you will. And so those areas are significantly deep, 25 feet plus in regular water years. The use of dredging was evaluated here, but it's never really been done before anywhere from an aquatic invasive species control standpoint. So I think that would have to be analyzed further to show what capability that would have from a follow-up method, if you will.
Okay.
You would still run into those same concerns with aluminum toxicity, turbidity, dewatering, where do the spoils go, how do you dispose of those? So that would have to be looked at a larger level.
Okay. Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you, Shelley. Thanks, Shelley. I appreciate it. Jim.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. And thank you, Dennis, for the presentation and also the folks from GKPOA. Really good. I've heard this before, but I always learn something new every time I hear it. So I do really appreciate that. My question is on the monitoring. Actually, this morning in the EITPO committee, we had a really good discussion on the importance of monitoring when you're doing pilot projects. So kind of following up on John's questions regarding monitoring this on this, you know, how well does this take care of spreading weeds out into the lake? We also, you know, reading through some of the correspondence, I saw some comments regarding, I think, concern that application of herbicides doesn't typically be a one and done deal. And so I kind of read from that a concern of ongoing application of herbicides, which then to me gets to monitoring as well. So my understanding is that the Tahoe Science Advisory Council, which, you know, has independent researchers from various institutions and various expertise, did a peer review. And I think I saw it on the slide, but you didn't talk about it much. So I'm just curious on what were the comments from the Science Advisory Council regarding the adequacy of the monitoring? Did they have comments that were incorporated? How did that relationship go?
Yeah, so the Tahoe Science Advisory Council weighed in on two different aspects, if you will. One with the test project and the design itself, and then also the adequacy and comprehensiveness of the analysis. And then separately, through the Lahontan process, their permit procedures require a mitigation monitoring and reporting program. And that is something the Tahoe Keys developed with some scientific assistance with consultants. And that portion or a portion of that mitigation monitoring reporting program was then peer reviewed by the Tahoe Science Advisory Council. And it's my understanding that they determined that reporting program to be more than adequate, more than satisfactory. Like, oh, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but that was their peer review provided positive feedback.
Thanks, Dennis. And maybe to answer to question a little different, was there any recommendations from the Tahoe Science Advisory Council that was made to perhaps improve the project or point out things that were deficient? Were there any recommendations that were not incorporated into this sort of final proposal?
Yeah, to my recollection, there was nothing that they recommended that we didn't either consider or incorporate.
Thanks, Dennis.
Thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate those questions. And Ashley, please.
Thank you. Thanks to all the presenters. This was incredibly thorough. I think I mostly have a follow-up question to what John Friedrich was asking. Just thinking about the timeline for this pilot and the limited acreage on which the application would take place. Like thinking about that graph you showed with the sort of exponential spread, I do worry about that spread continuing to occur outside of the pilot area. And so just was wondering, you know, if in that year one of the pilot application, things are going well, is there some opportunity to expand the acreage of the pilot or do another one elsewhere just to really try to control this? So that's kind of one question. And the second is, with those control curtains and the other measures you're putting in place, will all of the, will you really be able to say that the changes are completely attributable to the treatment? Meaning, you know, will weeds be able to kind of climb back in some of those areas independent of the treatment so that you may not see that 75% reduction? I'm just thinking about these sort of unintended consequences that could delay expansion of the pilot and just making sure we've controlled for all of those.
So regarding the first question about the ability to expand acreage within the test, that is not part of the proposal. The specifically with a Lahontan permit, it is very specific regarding how test treatments are applied, but also what we understand from our previous experience in other projects is that it's not a one and done. So a 1 year of a test is not necessarily indicative of the long-term success. These treatment programs elsewhere in the lake are multiple years, and so we need to take that time to really evaluate the longer term of a one-year test or a one-year portion of the test to understand the efficacy. In regards to the turbidity curtains and other aspects, you know, what we're looking at is areas somewhat isolated, so trying to maximize our ability to track efficacy of those treatment programs. And perhaps, Dr. Anderson, if you can weigh in more on that test design and the monitoring in regards to that question.
Sure. I think one of the things that's important about the design of the curtains that they are not except one side, which has curtains around most of the site. Most of these curtains are separated from the actual treatment site by some distance, but still protecting the rest of the lagoon. And the reason for that, too, is that we don't want the curtains per se to affect the treatment and the post-treatment conditions that occur with these treatment methods. So it's a good question. But I think that the way it's designed, the effect that the treatment effects on the target plants and non-target species are going to be pretty indicative of a typical site like that and won't be impacted by the presence of those curtains for 21 days in there.
Okay, and I guess just one follow-up on that. So just knowing how long it will take to get this first permit, when would there be plans to potentially, you know, if this is going well, to potentially apply for additional permits to expand treatments across the lake? Like, what's the time frame there?
Yeah, as the project, the test project, assuming it's approved, is put in place, data collection is going to be ongoing with that monitoring and water quality sampling, along with the efficacy monitoring each season. And we anticipate that we would be able to start another environmental review process in the middle of the test project. So giving us a little bit of a head start, if you will, to maximize the urgency, if possible. So we can start that process as soon as we can.
Ashley?
Okay, thank you. Oh, yeah, Ashley, go ahead.
This is Joanne Marchetta. I want to be sure we're answering your question because there are already treatments going on in these satellite populations all around the lake. And so I just want to be sure that's not your question.
No, I remember hearing that in a previous briefing about all the other treatments. Just really interested in this one and potential expansion of this approach.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, though.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the questions, Ashley. I'd like to move to Wes, please.
Thank you, Mark. Over here in the Round Hill General Improvement District, we have been very concerned about the proposed use of herbicides ever since they were first discussed. My concern and question, since we take our water out of the lake right at Round Hill Pines, what would happen if the herbicide is detected coming out into the lake? Is there any mitigation once that gets into the lake proper?
Well, certainly the test is designed and the analysis reflects that that's not a likely outcome. And as Dr. Anderson suggested or discussed, that continual monitoring would happen outside of those turbidity curtains, and then also with the test design of treating early when the keys is still filling up with water to prevent that spread from happening. And so that is a very unlikely event that any potential herbicides would spread into the lake or then even make it that far to the nearest drinking water intake.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't have any. Oh, there's Haley. Haley, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. I know the study has looked at herbicide use in other lakes, and I just wanted to share a quick personal anecdote. I grew up in Wisconsin. Our lake did have herbicides added to it, a lake that was very near and dear to my parents' heart, my heart, that I grew up swimming in, fishing in, my kids swim in, and we were so supportive of the use of herbicides. It's milfoil, the same pondweed, some of the same weeds we're looking at here. Excuse me, because we couldn't use the lake. The spread of some of the weeds was so invasive in this lake in Wisconsin, you actually couldn't swim anymore. And I remember like my mom weeding up to waist level, trying to get some of this out to even be able to access the water. And it happened within a span of 10 years. So I just share that. I know it's a different body of water in a different climate, but I still swim there. I still eat the fish out of there. And it's very anecdotal, but just so you all know, it saved the lake that I grew up on. So for what it's worth, a personal story on the herbicides.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, I don't see anyone else on the chat, but I'm looking for hands. I'm looking for verbal cues. I'm not seeing any. At this point in time, not seeing any. Thanks again, Dennis, and the whole team for a really fantastic briefing on this. Really important. This was information only. And so at this point in time, we're going to go to public comment. Any member of the public wishes to address the governing board on these agenda items, please raise your hand now and go to webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff. I'll turn it over to Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I point members of the public to the hand-raising button, which is on the left-hand side of your GoToWebinar control panel. And also let the members of the public know if you're speaking on behalf of an organization, we will offer you up to 5 minutes to make your comments, and individuals have 3 minutes. And with that, Kaylin McGee, if you'd like to unmute yourself, you can address the governing board.
Good afternoon. My name is Kaylin McGee. I am a facilitator. My company is Zephyr Collaboration. It's been my pleasure to work with the stakeholder committee for almost 3 years now. The committee consists of the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association, Tahoe Resource Conservation District, Tahoe Water Suppliers Association, and the League to Save Lake Tahoe. Lead agencies participate in these discussions, but are not authors of the products and the reports. Due to the hard work of this group over 3 years, they've accomplished many things. They and other partners and members of the public have helped shape the goals and approach of this, the development of this test and its environmental review, specifically early in the process after considerable work. This group forged an agreement that made it clear that a test is needed in order to inform a long-term design. And therefore, the applicant changed the design. Also during this period, they learned a lot about the Keys itself, baseline conditions, sources of nutrients in its cycling, the status of emergent tech, and how it might fit in the Keys environments. This group reviewed closely the development of the test design, the development of the monitoring plan, the environmental review, and the development of a draft permit. Also, this group participated in the design and engagement of different members of the public and partners. One way they demonstrated influence over was the inclusion of a very robust no-action alternative, or an evaluation of what happens if you consider with the status quo, and in the environmental report, this turns out to be the riskiest, potentially most damaging option of all. I'll conclude by pointing you to a summary report of this group of their work for 3 years. There are lots of ways to get there, but the easiest is on the project website, TahoeKeysWeeds.org, TahoeKeysWeeds.org, where this report includes the activities of the stakeholder committee and other public engagement. It includes some shared perspectives of the stakeholder committee members. It also includes some individual statements and was packaged this way intentionally so that you can get a feel for the context and nuance and some important details of this very important project in consideration of this test. I won't attempt to summarize the report. I think the report speaks for itself. I will, though, in closing, just point out a couple of the themes from the shared perspectives, which are that the problem is getting worse and quickly, that a test is needed to really inform a long-term management plan, and that the environmental review and test design was rigorous and cooperative. Thanks. That's all I have for you today.
Next up, Jesse Patterson.
Hi, everyone. This is Jesse Patterson with the League to Save Lake Tahoe. Good afternoon, board, chair, and members. I am the Chief Strategy Officer for the League to Save Lake Tahoe, and thank you for this opportunity to speak today. I should be able to fit it within the 3 minutes. The League is the largest and oldest organization focused on protection of water quality and clarity of Lake Tahoe, and we've had 65 years of experience and success in achieving this mission. Thank you for the great presentation today and the chance to speak. The Tahoe Keys has been a top priority for the League for almost a decade as it poses one of the largest threats to Lake Tahoe's unique and delicate ecology, and if left unsolved, could damage the lake we know and love forever. My comments today are to relay the League's strong support for the proposed control methods test and to provide some context on our involvement for the last decade. In the last decade, we've committed thousands of hours of staff time and expertise, as well as over $200,000 in direct funding to support innovative pilot projects to address this challenge. I've personally participated in several iterations of the Tahoe Keys related stakeholder committees over the last 9 years, including the most recent effort that has led to the CMT proposal in front of you today. Outside of the CMT process, in 2018, we helped the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association design, implement, and fund the first ever bubble curtain used to help contain the spread of aquatic invasive weeds. Each year, we've helped improve and expand the curtain, which is now being used in other parts of Lake Tahoe, including the Elk Point Marina and the east side marina side channel of the Keys. We're also going to continue to improve and monitor these curtains. We have funded additional monitoring in Lake Tahoe in 2018 and 19 to inform and support the current control work on the Tahoe Keys complex, which was mentioned. It's 10 times larger than any other infestation in the lake proper. And we also provided funding for the control work that was conducted there in 2020 and 21. So we're very committed to addressing the lake impacts. We also funded the implementation of laminar flow aeration in the Tahoe Keys lagoons to reduce sediment nutrient sources for the weeds. The 5.9-acre project has been operating since April of 2019, so we have a couple years under our belt, and it helped to inform the current CMT while also being included in the project for further testing. So while all of these efforts have been helpful and do show promise towards helping the control of the aquatic weed infestation, it's become very clear that they're not enough alone, nor a long-term solution without additional tools in the toolbox. For these reasons, and the ones following, the League strongly supports the CMT project and encourages this board to approve the project as proposed with all proposed control methods when it comes before you in January. Current methods are not enough to address the problem, and some are actually making it worse. The design of the test is scientifically based, poses no significant threat to Lake Tahoe, even while considering the limited use of targeted herbicides, which was a very important consideration for us. And the environmental analysis actually showed that the no action alternative poses the greatest significant impact to the lake. The public process and environmental analysis of the project were above and beyond anything ever undertaken for a test project, which we advocated for because this is Lake Tahoe. And the extensive monitoring and mitigation plan for the project will ensure that we learn as much as possible about what tools may work while also informing how to apply those methods in a way that ensures protection of the lake. All proposed methods need to be tested at the same time in order to compare them in isolation and combination. And we're running out of time. Lake Tahoe is too important to not do as much as we can right now. Thank you, and we look forward to continuing this work with TRPA staff and other partners on this very urgent matter.
Thank you, Jesse.
Okay, next up, David Blau.
Okay, can you hear me now?
We can, David.
Okay. Loud and clear. Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having us. My comments are approximately 4 minutes. First of all, I have been a homeowner on the West Shore for 33 years with my family. I am on the board of the League to Save Lake Tahoe as well as the program chair. And I have 38 years experience directing and preparing NEPA and CEQA documents. So I think I know what I'm talking about. Jesse mentioned the overriding mission of the League to protect water quality and clarity. We cannot do this without cleaning up the Keys. And for those with concerns, we have to understand that lake health and the health of the Keys are inseparable. Inseparable, and we're having devastating effects on the lake because we haven't solved the Keys problem. I want to give you a perspective on the document. A number of us at the League have read the whole 600-page EIR, EIS. We're probably very few who have done that. It's extremely thorough, comprehensive, and legally defensible. We especially appreciate the way the no action alternative was treated. In my career, I've never seen the no action being taken through every technical topic of concern. And the conclusion was that the no action is the most adverse and will do the greatest harm to the lake. So we have a compelling case for action. We support the proposed project, namely the three tools that are in category A: UV light, laminar flow aeration, and the testing in year one of two EPA-approved herbicides, both separately and in combination with each other. Herbicide test, as was mentioned in the presentation, would only occur in the spring of the first year when water is flowing from the lake into the Keys. There will be double turbidity curtains, rigorous monitoring, lower dosage than EPA allows, and it's only being done in 17 out of 172 acres. But back to Jim Good's presentation, all he really needed to say was the bottom line conclusion, which is no significant impact was found to environmental health, water quality, or aquatic biology. That's the key bottom line finding. All tools need to be tested. That's what the three-year CMT is all about. And we can't waste 3 years without testing all the tools in the toolbox. Finally, let me make a couple comments about some of the misconceptions and misinformation that's been floating around for 3-4 years. I think it's meant to confuse and scare people more than to solve a problem. Examples: herbicides would be required every year. That is flat out not true. We do not know if it's done once and it knocks back the biomass 5%, we might be able to maintain these channels with other tools. It would open the floodgates for using herbicides all over the lake. Also, not true at all. Every single application would require an exemption from Lahontan and would have to go through the same rigorous analysis and the CEQA analysis. We haven't exhaustively tested all methods. We have 12, 15 years of study, 5 years of preparing the environmental documents, millions of dollars spent, and thousands of staff hours and science, expert scientists, and peer review going on. I would argue that that is pretty exhaustive work that's been done. So to finalize, we can't ignore cleaning up the Keys at the continued expense of the lake. And I would love for some of the naysayers to think more broadly, beyond just the Keys, what is the harm being done each year to the ecology of the lake? I think if they thought that way, that it's not just the Keys problem, it's a lake-wide problem. Thanks for giving us the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Next hand raise is Toby Tyler. Toby, if you unmute yourself, you can address the board. Okay, Toby, we'll come back to you. Mike Plasiak, if you unmute yourself, you can address the board.
Yeah, thank you very much. This is Mike Plasiak. I'm the executive officer for the Lahontan Water Board. And I just wanted to say that I appreciate the collaborative efforts that have gone on between the TRPA team, my team here at Lahontan. And as a result, I think we have a very solid package that we'll be taking a permitting package to include the EIR and our MPDS permit and basin plan exemptions we'll be bringing to the board on January 12th. So that's a testament to the work that we've been doing together, and appreciate the leadership that Joanne and her team have provided to assist the Lahontan Water Board staff. That's all I have.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
William Evers. William, if you'd like to make a comment, please unmute yourself.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, thanks, Will.
Yeah, hi, sorry about that. Hello, everybody. Thank you very much. Good to see some of you, some of the familiar faces. My name is William Evers. I'm the chair of the league. And I've been the chair for a couple of years. I've been on the board for about six. And I will be brief here, echoing David's comments and Jesse's comments. Shelley, I have one comment for you. I think that area on that map is where we vacuumed, and that's why it's clear. So that's just one quick comment. I want to share with you, my father was the founder of the league, and or one of the founders of the league back in the late 50s. And the impetus for him working with Assemblyman Pete McCloskey was that they wanted to put a four-lane highway down the West Shore and a bridge over Emerald Bay. And my father thought that was not a good idea. And I think that the Keys is that an Emerald Bay, a bridge over Emerald Bay moment that we all need to recognize as something that's really a cancer on the lake that needs to be addressed and with some urgency. If we don't, Mike P., thank you for your comments about Lahontan. I really hope it passes. If we don't pass it in January, it's a whole other year before we can get started. So I hope everyone has a sense of urgency. I think the rationale and methodology is pretty unassailable, and I hope we can move forward with it. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Will.
Next commenter is John Moore. John, if you unmute yourself, you can address the governing board.
First, I'll ask if I'm audible.
Yes, you are, John.
Thank you.
Sure.
I believe this would be addressed to Dennis Sabago. You stated that the Tahoe Science Advisory Council endorsed the entire control methods test. The only an endorsement of the monitoring program is on the Manhattan Water Board website, and the report of the endorsement did not contain any justification of the assertions that the monitoring was adequate. It appears to me to be very limited in terms of number of monitoring locations, both inside and outside the sites, and in terms of the water quality parameters that are monitored, and in terms of the frequency of monitoring. So that's my question.
Thank you. For purposes of this public comment, we don't answer questions generally. So, but your public comment is very well received, and we appreciate your participation.
The last hand raised is Toby Tyler. Toby, I'm coming back to you. If you can unmute yourself, you can address the board.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, very faintly. So if you can turn up your mic just a little bit.
Okay, I'll try to speak louder. This is Toby Tyler. I'm with the Sierra Club, Tahoe Area Group, and I wasn't planning on talking today, but I have a few things to respond to here. First, I want to echo John Moore's comment. One thing that was not mentioned during the presentation by Jim Good was the fact that the draft environmental document stated numerous times that the environmentally superior alternative was the non-chemical methods alternative. Also, herbicides do nothing about the nutrients in the sediment, which will continue to nourish the weeds. In addition, no one here is addressing the real problem, which is the structure of the Keys lagoons themselves and their stagnant warm waters, which, along with the nutrients in the sediments, will continue to grow weeds. And lastly, Lahontan's Basin Plan Amendment allowed an exemption for herbicide discharges requires the testing of all non-chemical methods be demonstrated to be ineffective, and that clearly has not been done, despite what you've heard earlier, particularly with regard to the newer methods of UV and LFA. I have searched everywhere, and I have not seen that demonstration. Clearly, this is headed toward herbicide treatments throughout Greater Lake Tahoe, as was commented on earlier by several of the board members, and wanting to see that happen, apparently. I don't need to tell you, or I shouldn't need to tell you, that Lake Tahoe is a Tier 3 outstanding national resource water and should be treated better than this. And everyone really needs to look at solutions. And I've said this numerous times in many comment letters, and I have not received any response as to, you know, what's the next plan, because this is ongoing treatment of herbicides. I'm sorry to tell you this. That's where this is headed, and it's clear by the board members today that that's perfectly fine. So these are not. These toxic chemical band-aid solutions are not solutions at all. By the way, I have read the entire draft EIR, and I wrote 66 pages of comments, which I'm still awaiting response for. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, we had one more hand go up. Judith Simon, you had your hand raised, and then it looks like you put it down. I just want to make sure if you'd like to address the board on this item. Go ahead and unmute yourself.
Okay, yes, I was a bit confused. I understand that some 3,000 comments have been filed with the Lahontan Water Board, and I'm wondering if they will be providing any kind of analysis and if those comments are available. Lake Tahoe may not be at risk from this limited test, but it is at risk if herbicides are successful. I'm curious about the pumps, pipes, and sewage disposal in the Keys and the integrity of those systems, as well as the propensity for residents to establish and maintain lawns with the runoff risk inherent in that. Many Lakeshore residents, including me, drink water from the lake with only minimal processing, and we rely on the Tahoe Water Suppliers Association to maintain that integrity of our water supply. I understand the association continues to raise concerns about herbicide use. If herbicides are approved, TRPA will set a dangerous precedent. What if one application is not enough? I find it difficult to believe that one application in this test will not be repeated, especially since it's been shown in other waterways that repeated, stronger applications have been needed as weeds become resistant to chemical treatments. Other methods to deal with plants and animal life in the lake have had unintended consequences. For example, the introduction of the mysis shrimp as a potential food supply for fish seems to have resulted in contributing to the diminution of lake clarity. I understand that TRPA, in conjunction with the U.S. Forest Service, has begun a large invasive plant removal projects in Taylor and Tillac Creek that do not include the use of herbicides. I really urge you to keep on studying the issue and push for ongoing stormwater and fertilizer improvements, such as removing grass from the edge of water, landscaping, and adding storm drain inlet filters. Closing off the Keys or installing a boat lock system could achieve a lake-wide goal of limiting the spread of invasive weeds from boating activity, boating being a known vector for spreading invasive plant and animal life. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, there are no further hands raised to comment on this item.
Okay, I'd like to bring it back to the board for any further comment, any further discussion. This is information only, so but I would like to round out any further discussion. If there are answers to Mr. Moore's question that might be helpful, if there are any responses to Toby's criticisms, that might be as helpful as well. But those are just thoughts. So if staff would like to jump in on that, that'd be fine. If not, anybody else have any questions or comments on this item?
Mr. Chair, this is Dennis Spaglow. I can just briefly clarify Mr. Moore's comment regarding the Tahoe Science Advisory Council. Endorsement is not a word I believe I use, but however, regarding the Tahoe Science Advisory Council's peer review of the mitigation monitoring reporting program, I think that's what he was referring to on the Lahontan website. But during the draft analysis release, both agencies received public comment from the Tahoe Science Advisory Council. So that is not put on a website, but is included in the public comment and responses to comments that will be available with the final release, which I believe addresses a question Toby, Ms. Tyler had regarding responses to comments, that they will all be included in that release of the final environmental analysis.
Understood. Thank you so much for those clarifications and responses. Seeing no further chats, no further hands raised or audible indications of further interest on this item. Thank you so much for, again, Dennis, you have done a remarkable job. Your team has done a remarkable job. Thank you for taking it so seriously and for bringing us so much valuable scientific information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to move to 7B, update on aquatic invasive species prevention program 2022 budget. Information on this item can be found on page 207. As a reminder to the public, after staff presentation and board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in the GoToWebinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. At this point in time, I'd like to hand this over to Tom.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the board. I am promising you a more exciting talk, low science, but budget stuff. So buckle in. Next slide, please, Tracy. So there are some new board members, and I wanted to just give a quick little background about the program to set the context for this discussion, and I'll get into that further in the next agenda item as well. But the prevention program requires all motorized watercraft to be inspected before they enter the lake, and they need to purchase a sticker as well to launch. We have three stations around the lake, one at Alpine Meadows, Spooner Summit, and in Myers, where we conduct the inspections to prevent the introduction of any AIS. What we look for is any mud, plants, animal, or water on these vessels. So if we do find some of those things, then we require a decontamination, and then that boat is then inspected again to make sure that it's clean, drained, and dried. Then we sell them a sticker, which is essentially a receipt for a proof of inspection. We then seal the boat to the trailer, so it's linked together. So if that boat were to launch somewhere else and break that seal, they wouldn't be able to enter Lake Tahoe. So then we have seal inspectors that are trained by our staff to inspect that seal to make sure that they are intact again. Next slide. I'm hitting my button here. The program has been incredibly successful. So we are considered the gold standard in the West, if not the nation. We have no new invasives introduced into the lake since the program began 13 years ago. A lot of this is due to the contract that we have with the Tahoe Resource Conservation District. They have been implementing the program since its inception, and their knowledge and expertise is invaluable to this success. And the success of the program largely is in part because we're constantly growing. We're steadily growing and adapting to all the challenges that we're facing, and then making modifications to improve as we go along. Next, please. So into the fun stuff, the budget. The rising costs over the last few years have put us into a moment of shortfalls. And we brought this to your attention last year. We are asked to provide a long-term budget strategy in collaboration with our partners. And so that's why I'm here today. Next. So one of the biggest things we're able to do is secure funding. We applied for grants through the California Department of Boating and Waterways. Each of these grants that we received were for 2 years, $400,000. That made a huge boost to program solvency. And the other aspect, and I'll get into the appointment system a little bit later, but we had an appointment system which had a convenience fee associated with it that brought in $51,000. And then we have the Aquatic Nuisance Species Task Force, which brings us $92,000 each year. And then kind of an as-needed fund with the Lake Tahoe Restoration Act of up to $300,000 annually. So these secured funding sources have really bolstered the program. Next, please. One of the biggest cost-saving measures that we implemented last year and will continue this year is we are operating three inspection stations instead of four. In 2019, we had four stations. COVID impacts last year kind of forced us into three because we were having such a hard time hiring people. And the savings that we're gaining from that are going to be, it's around $119,000 annually. So we're going to continue with that model. And again, the program staff is going to continue to make adjustments as needed to address any unexpected shortfalls. We're going to continue to investigate program improvements, any cost-saving measures, and other revenue sources to ensure program sustainability. And of course, we're going to continue to apply for grants annually. Next, please. So the good news that I'm very happy to share with you is the program has stable funding for the next three calendar years, and that operating budget is approximately $2 million. Next. So in summary, our goal is to maintain the highest level of protections to the lake while providing excellent customer service to the boaters that want to recreate on Lake Tahoe. Competitive wages need to be dedicated to get well-trained staff. We all know about the hiring issues that we face in the Lake Tahoe Basin, and you'll be hearing more about that for me in my next presentation. But being able to get good staff that stick around for multiple years pays so many dividends in the long term for the program from stability standpoint, but also customer service and just basic efficiencies. So we've addressed the short and long-term funding challenges, but we're going to continue to work on that long-term program solvency 3 years and beyond as the program evolves to the rapidly changing landscape that we are continually facing.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Tom, for the presentation. Really appreciate it. Questions, comments from the board? I don't see any in the...
I have a quick question.
Yes, please.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't have a chance to chat it.
Yeah.
Thanks. Go ahead. Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome.
A very successful program. Good job. Thanks for the report. And just kind of connecting a dot to the last presentation, I think this you know, the inspection program has done a good job of dealing with external threats, but we have the homegrown ones, I guess the ones that are just in the lake that are moving through AIS inspected areas, like the Keys Lagoons and going into the lake. So there been any exploration of any possibilities of doing inspections of boats already here that are moving through AIS areas? I know it would be tricky, you know, whether it's divers or boat lifts, or, you know, we talked about the boat backup stations and the bubble curtains, which have been funded by a third party, the league. So I just, you know, given this is seems to be the dominant threat, as we've heard, to the lake from boats not coming outside but from within. Any thoughts or programmatic developments underway to address this that threat, or how to maybe deliver an inspection program for boats that are already on the lake in AIS areas?
Yeah, I'm sure Dennis will have some thoughts on this as well. But we did talk about this in relation to some comments that we received from some of our partners at the ramp facilities, launch facilities. And it's going to be really challenging to implement something like that, given the current situation. And so, in my opinion, it makes sense to continue on with this control testing and see how that shakes out. And then, depending on how all that works out, then we could more seriously dive into that aspect of it. I mean, it's kind of beyond the scope of the prevention program. So it would need to be married together. And then Dennis, if you have anything you want to add, feel free.
Sure. Thanks, Tom. The marina staff that we partner with at all the launch facilities, so they do provide that level of protection, if you will. Those staff are trained on an annual basis that Tom and his counterparts at the Tahoe Resource Conservation District, every year we go through training of those staff to look at their boats, even if they've already been inspected coming into the region from elsewhere. The local boats, if you will, are verified to ensure that they don't have any plants hanging from their boats, that their plugs have to be pulled prior to arriving or as they leave, so you're not spreading any of those existing species in ballast waters. And then also as part of the shoreline program, an additional some of the fees that were part of that program, there's an additional one associated with the boat inspection sticker that allows for, forgetting the exact number, but I believe it's a $12 addition to that sticker that allows for continual lake-wide monitoring and rapid response to address existing species.
Right. But nothing in place or contemplated. Maybe it's the logistics are the challenge. But to, again, in the Keys Lagoon scenario, the boat goes through the curly pondweed infected area. And then before it, some 90% or that you said back up and presumably the weeds fall off. But could it be feasible at some level, a test program to inspect the boat to see if it's actually containing AIS before it continues on its journey? And I don't know if that would require a boat lift or a diver or what have you, but just some program to look at the boats that are traveling through weed infected areas and then, bringing them to the lake.
As part of the boat inspect, I'm sorry, as part of the boat backup station and the bubble curtain that was put in place with assistance from the league and the TKPOA, there's video footage demonstrating its efficacy as it's been in place over time. And that's a video we can share with you that shows how the boat backup station kind of throws off the attached weeds, if you will, as it then would proceed through the bubble curtain and then out to the lake proper.
Okay, well, yeah, I look forward to seeing that. And it seemed like that would be an opportunity to expand or make it 100%, if possible.
Great. Thank you, John. Thank you. Did you have anything further, John? Okay. So I'm looking at chat. Vince has a question. And after Vince, I think Bill was raising his hand. So Vince, please.
Thank you. I was just curious, Tom, if you have any idea what the compliance rate is on inspections. Do people bypass? Is it 100%? Is it 90%? If you have any idea. And then also, it's just kind of frightening thinking one boat could bring in a lot of bad things, that it's that fragile. What other kind of backstops are put in place to make sure those boats don't get into the water? It sounded like Dennis was saying there's some training of launch facility staff. So I'm just kind of curious what else is there.
Yeah, I wish I could say compliance was 100%, but in a water body this large, it's not going to be 100%, but I could say it's 99.99%. Motorized watercraft need to be inspected. All the ramps have SEAL inspectors present by our code that the gate is locked if they don't have staff there to inspect that boat for that SEAL. When it comes to non-motorized watercraft, that's a little bit trickier because they're subject to inspection and they could launch from someone's front yard. But one of the biggest tools that we have is word of mouth and the people who care about Lake Tahoe that let us know if they see illegal launching going on. There's a couple every year due to ignorance or whatever it may be, but that is really the biggest tool that we have, is that people understand the code and the rules and let us know, so then we can have that conversation and hope like heck they were not infested. But yeah, I mean, I'm confident that the compliance rate is really, really high.
That's a great question. If I can jump in, this is Dennis again. As Tom reported, we've had no new invasions since the program began. So I think that is a testament to the efficacy and compliance with the program. Along with our partners at the marinas, this is in their best interest as well. They have a stake in the lake, quite literally. And so we rely on them as well. And that's part of the training that we take on with them on an annual basis. But then we also do a pretty rigorous quality control and quality assurance program in the form of the Rich Hopper program that Tom oversees. We have an independent third party come in and do a secret shopper evaluation of not only our boat inspection stations, but also the ramps themselves, where they try to make excuses at the inspection station, if you will, or try to launch without the steel that we use. And to date, that has not shown any infractions, if you will. And so we're confident that we have a very, very high level of compliance.
Thank you, Dennis. Thank you, Tom. Going to Bill. Did you have your hand up, Bill? Hello?
I'm just having trouble every once in a while hearing people, and maybe they're having trouble hearing me. So it just could be my end here, windy weather out here in Sacramento. I don't know. I'm just wondering if it's okay if I go off my video, which improves my system here. And maybe Marshall or someone would tell me whether that's kosher now that we have the capability.
Bill, this is John. Yes, that's okay.
Great.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Bye, guys.
Okay, any other hands? Any other voices? Jump in. At this point in time, I don't see anything, so we'll go to public comment. If any member of the public wishes to address the governing board on this agenda item, please raise your hand now and go to webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff, and I will turn it over to Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will direct members of the public to the hand-raising button on the left-hand side of your control panel, and please click it just once and keep your hand up until I can call on you. John Moore, you are unmuted and can address the governing board.
Well, I presume I'm audible again.
Yes, you are.
Given my interest in aquatic invasive plant control, do the reports of the AIS prevention program give information about the frequency with which aquatic invasive plants are detected by the inspection program?
Dennis, are you still on?
Yes. I'm not 100% sure I was able to comprehend.
He's asking whether or not when an inspection occurs and you find invasive species, whether that's documented and whether or not the number of the frequency is documented.
Yes, all environmental improvement program projects have a tracking mechanism, if you will, for metrics with the environmental improvement program project tracker that's part of Lake Tahoe Info, where all of our partners upload metrics from each season. And so that's something we definitely track with the number of boats that are intercepted with some form of aquatic invasive, and then also the number of boats that are arriving clean, drain, and dry. That's an important metric, too, to understand how our outreach is working to the boaters that are doing what they can to come clean, drain, and dry, which is part of the prevention aspect. And so we track both of those components.
Thank you, Dennis. Okay, Catherine, anybody else?
No, Mr. Chair, there are no other hands raised to make a comment.
Okay, great. Thank you, both Tom and Dennis, again. Very much appreciated. That was informational only. We're going to public hearings, item 8. 8A is the 2022, give me one second. Okay. 8A is the 2022 watercraft inspection fee structure. Information on this item is 209. As a reminder to the public, after staff presentation, board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand at the GoToWebinar and be unmuted by TRPA staff and share your comments. I'll again pass it over to Tom.
Thank you, Chair. I forgot to introduce myself officially. My name is Thomas Booz, and I am the AIS Prevention Coordinator with the TRPA. So next slide, please,
Thank
Tracy.
You, Tom.
Yeah. The purpose is pretty simple, to request the governing board approve the watercraft inspection fee schedule for 2022. And I wanted to make a note on these stickers. This is what the stickers look like for the for the newer board members. And for those that have seen these stickers for 10 years now, there's something missing, which is the image of the lake behind the year. We wanted to reflect the regional aspect of the program. So we cover the lakes that have motorized access in the basin. So we included the other two lakes, Fallen Leaf Lake and Echo Lake. So things are going to look a little bit different this year, but function the same. Next, please. So again, the background, I already mentioned the requirement for inspections. Inspection fee categories are based on boat size. We require fees for both inspection and decontamination. And there's three types of stickers: a Tahoe only, which is for those boats that typically do not leave Lake Tahoe. They exit the water body, get a seal put on. They can come right back to the launch ramp, have their seal checked and then removed again and repeat that process. A Tahoe in and out is essentially an annual inspection sticker, so you can come as much as you want throughout the year for inspections. And then lastly, the single inspection pass. Next, please, Tracy. So a little bit of recap for 2021. It was another really interesting year. As I mentioned, we operated three stations, and part of that was the challenge that we have in hiring. And we wanted to simplify the program from a staffing standpoint, as well as saving some costs. Like I mentioned earlier, $119,000 we save by operating in three stations. And I hate to say it, but it was another unprecedented year. We overcame challenge after challenge. It started with the COVID-19 impacts, which we addressed just like we did in 2020 with social distancing, wearing masks, sanitation, asking boaters to be socially distant and stay in their cars when possible. But the big one was smoke and evacuation impacts. I'll get into that in a little bit more later. But another big thing that we did is we listened to the boaters. The appointment system was really successful. We listened to boaters, and they certainly enjoyed and want the certainty and convenience that we offered this year. The most important thing in my mind is we took a chance by operating three stations in a kind of normal year. I mean, we opened up late in 2020 with COVID, so it was a really hard year to assess things. But 2021 was mostly normal, and we met the demands. With the three stations and the staff that we had, we were able to meet the demands that the boaters brought to the lake. Next, please, Tracy. So the appointment system was just a wonderful success, and it was in reaction to COVID in 2020 that we started an appointment system where every boat that came to the lake had to have an appointment. We needed that controlled setting, and we needed to manage the demand, because we didn't know what to expect then. So we thought the appointment system worked. Let's do it again. And what makes me really, really excited about this is when you devise a plan, something like this, something new, you're taking a chance to see if it's going to work. We wanted to spread the flow of boaters coming to the lake between the stations, but also throughout the week to minimize that weekend demand. Typically, 41% of the boats that we see come on Friday and Saturday. And without a doubt, the appointment system spread that out. There are some stations that are more busy than others. And again, that balanced out because people were trying to find their appointment that worked for them. They really wanted that certainty of an inspection time and not waiting in a line. And so what that did, by maximizing the amount of boats that are each station each day of the week, we maximized our capacity of our staff. I mean, typically like a Tuesday would be relatively slow, where there's a lot of downtime. It didn't happen this year. So we're getting the most out of our staff. They're gaining experience quickly, and it's a more controlled environment where they're able to perform their jobs more effectively and provide better customer service. And we allowed, we accepted both appointments, and you can leave it there, Tracy. We accepted both appointments and walk-ins. And along with the appointment, we charged a $15 convenience fee. That's what I mentioned earlier, where that brought us in $51,000 in extra revenue. So some of the lessons learned: the controlled setting to address COVID was highly successful again. Our staff stayed healthy. As far as we know, the boaters stayed healthy, and it really helped to keep that morale high at the beginning of the season, knowing that we were doing those practices again to ensure safety and confidence in our staff. But staffing gaps greatly impact the program efficiency and effectiveness. So like I mentioned, we contract with the Tahoe Resource Conservation District. Their program managers were hiring up until the evacuation. And I've been here, this is my, this is the third completed season, and we haven't been fully staffed that entire time. And so that constant looking for people detracts from them doing their program duties to make the program more efficient and more effective, and just really empowering the staff that we have to be become better. Because, it's very complicated connectedness there. But the other really important lesson that we learned is the risk continues to grow. So the high demand that we experienced in 2020 with COVID continued. It was just as high, if not higher, this year. There's an increased interstate travel. Part of that is boaters, coming to Tahoe because of just staying in the country more. But also there's a boating shortage in the West Coast. And so people are purchasing boats all the way to the East Coast, having them transported here, which increases that risk because they're coming from potentially infested water bodies. And testament to that is we had 28 mussel infested boats this year. We had 20 in 2020. We had 11 or 12 in 2019. So it's going up quickly. And this is a great picture of Jana and Kelso inspecting a boat that just came from Lake Havasu, where we found some mussels. I love that photo. Another wonderful lesson is that because of the appointment system, someone has, half hour time slot. If their boat takes 15 minutes to inspect and there's no decontamination needed, we have better opportunity to engage with that boater and explain what it means to arrive clean, drain, dry, what we expect, to simplify their process and speed things up the next time. And the last lesson learned is that operating smoke is really, really challenging. We were forced to develop a policy on the fly, really reaching out to a bunch of partners in the West to find out what kind of air quality index they use as the cutoff point, and listening to our inspectors that were in the field. And there were a lot of days that we had to close down because of the smoke and obviously the impacts to the evacuation. Next, please. So long-term program challenges are going to continue. Program costs are increasing. Again, we need to maintain competitive wages to get staff hired and not be hiring people throughout the summer. Annual operational costs. And the most important thing is the inspections and decontaminations are the most important work that we do to prevent AIS getting into Lake Tahoe. Again, I'm going to continually harp on the hiring challenges continue, because I don't see this changing anytime soon. We did budget for a pretty significant increase to the inspector wages, and hoping that will make a difference for us in 2022. And I don't see smoke impacts being a one-year issue. I think this is going to be facing the program for years to come, and that is the value of having that policy in place. And that policy really helps us to communicate better with our staff, because there were some really rough days for those people where they wanted to work because they need the money, they wanted to provide that service, but it was also unhealthy. And so that policy helps us communicate with the staff, but also because we have the policy, then we can then communicate with the boaters, the public, to better inform them about what they can expect for closures. And of all this, this should have been a lesson learned between COVID in 2020 and the smoke and evacuation issues from this year. We are getting absolutely tenfold the traffic on our website, and that's what we want everybody to do, because that's where they can stay up to date on all the daily information, including social media, which has been a huge help in us to communicate with the public as these things change quickly. Next, please, Tracy. So again, some of the adaptations based on the lessons learned. We need to continue to invest in staff. Like I got to earlier, the program staff needs to interact with our leadership or with the site supervisors to provide better guidance to them on how to supervise their staff, because it's a tough job. There's issues that come up, and we need to get in front of that as best we can to make sure that these people enjoy their job, are providing that customer service, are inspecting the boats, and leaving their position in a better place to pursue their career, whatever that may be. And again, we are we strive to maintain high level of customer service in everything that we do. Every thought that goes into the program is related to customer service. Again, we operated 3 stations instead of 4, maximizing staff, capacity of the staff. And then using the appropriate fee increases to reflect the service provided, and I'll get into that in a moment, and then enhancing the services was another adaptation. So the appointment system and allowing for walk-ins. Next, please, Tracy. So to the fees, we are proposing no changes for 2022. It will be the same as you see here from 2021. Next. However, we do propose a fee increase for the decontaminations. So in 2021, we had 3 categories, a simple decontamination, which is a single system decon, like an engine, complex decontamination, which is multiple systems, and then attached mussels. So if a boat had attached mussels, we'd charge $250 to do the decontamination on that because it just is a much more time-consuming effort. But what we're learning, or what we've learned, is that ballast boats create a much more time-consuming process at the station. And so the simple decontamination fee of 20, we're proposing to raise to 25 just to compensate for the number of boats that come in that are just a single system. That's something that they can do on their own to dry that boat, and they're not. So we're trying to encourage people to arrive clean, drain, dry to avoid that fee. The ballast boats are about 17% of the boats that we see right now. And like I said, they take the most time to decontaminate. The 2 categories that you see here are drained and undrained. The drained means that the boat turned their pumps on and they did everything they could to expel the water. The undrained means they didn't. There's always water left in ballast tanks, and that's why we have to decontaminate every ballast boat that comes to our inspection station. So we wanted to recoup some of those costs and resources that it takes to do a decontamination. So the the ballast, the simple and complex decontaminations are for all boats. Then a subset of those boats with ballast tanks are in addition to the simple and complex. So if you come completely clean, drained, and dried, but you have your ballast tanks have that little residual water in the bottom that we need to treat, that would be $25. But if you come and your engine is wet and you have undrained ballasts, it would be $75. The maximum you're going to spend on a ballast boat decontamination would be $100 if you have multiple systems and the ballast tank is wet. It's not that complicated. And I didn't do the greatest of job of explaining that, so I hope you understood that. But the projected revenue increase from this is around $46,000, which to me is evident that there's a lot of resources and time that goes into decontaminating ballast boats. Now you can move on, Tracy. So in addition, I mentioned the increase of interstate travel. And more the last few years, we're getting large transport boats coming to Lake Tahoe. And so for several years, we've had a $200 fee for those transport boats for us to mobilize to the launch ramp where they may be, where they arrive. And this is the boat that just came recently to town, the Spirit of Tahoe, that I'm sure you saw in the news, you know, 70-foot boat, 120-foot trailer. It had to go right to the launch facility in order to be inspected and decontaminated. So that fee to mobilize recovered. But what we're proposing is another $50 an hour per staff to compensate us for that time. Because it's usually the program staff that are doing this because all the inspectors are at their inspection stations. And a couple of years ago, we had 1 or 2 of these. It's 3 or 4 the last couple of years. But as this interstate travel continues to increase, it's just going to go up and up, and it just takes a lot of our time and resources. So that's what this proposal is for. Next, please. So again, the summary: maintaining the highest level of protections to the lake, providing excellent customer service. Competitive wages are critical to get dedicated, well-trained staff, paying dividends in the long term. Like I said, if we have continuing staff, we're just better at doing our job. addressing short-term and long-term funding challenges and continuing to work on a long-term budget solvency and efficiencies.
Great. Thank you, Tom. Really appreciate it. Looks like I already have Shelley on chat. Shelley?
Thanks, Mark. Thank you, Tom. That was a very comprehensive report. But my one suggestion is, to me, it was a little confusing on the sticker fee schedule with respect to whether or not these fees are cumulative. And you did a good job of explaining what a simple versus a complex decontamination is. But can I suggest that perhaps you expand by defining those a little more clearly so people know what they're facing potentially in terms of a charge? Because initially when I read it, I thought, well, you get charged $25 if you have a drain ballast. And then if you need to be, you have a simple decontamination, then you're going to be charged another $50. I think it's a little complicated, but I think you could clarify that by defining those categories on the fee schedule itself.
Okay. Yeah. I'm happy to do that. And we do, most of the public is going to see this on our website, and we explain it in much more detail there about what a simple versus complex means. And so we can certainly bolster that a bit to make it more clear.
Okay. Well, if you don't think it's necessary, that's fine. I think the clearer, the better, so you can avoid shock.
I struggled putting this together because it's really simple in concept, but it's difficult to convey what we're trying to get at.
Right. Yeah. And I like, Shelley, I like your idea of a short description.
Yeah, and then, Tom, okay, when a motion is made regarding the amended fee schedule, do we need to include the $50 per hour per staff person charge to conduct those the inspection of large transport boats? Is that a new fee, hourly fee? And are you looking for the board to approve that as well?
Yes. I'm sorry I didn't make that clear, but yes, that is a new fee.
Okay, but the $200 is an existing fee, right, for decontamination and on-site inspection?
Correct.
Okay, perfect. Okay, thank you.
Very good.
This is John Marshall. Just on that point, when we get to the point of a motion, if we could use the errata that was sent out yesterday, late afternoon, I believe.
Yes, as part of the motion. Right.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Okay, any other questions or comments? I'm looking, listening, hearing, seeing nothing. So it's time to go to public comment. If any member of the public wishes to address the governing board on these agenda items, please raise your hand now and go to webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff, and I'll turn it over to Catherine to help me with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Okay, thank you so much. And so at this point in time, assuming no further comments or questions from my colleagues, I'm looking for a motion and for that motion to include the errata.
Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt the proposed resolution as contained in Attachment A, Exhibit 1, approving the 2022 watercraft inspection fee schedule and proposed watercraft inspection operations, including the information.
Thank you. John, are you good with that?
Yes, I am.
Great. Okay. Mario, will you please take the call the roll?
Ms. Aldean.
Ellie?
Yes.
We're calling the roll. Okay, yes. Thank you.
Ms. Conrad Seda?
Yes.
Mr. Woloshin?
Yes.
Ms. Faustinos? Ms. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Friedrich?
Yes.
Mr. Lawrence?
Yes.
Ms. Gustafson?
Yes.
Mr. Rice?
Yes.
Mr. Honigman? Mr. Honigman?
You may be on mute.
Okay, we'll, I'll come back. Ms. Williamson?
Yes.
Ms. Novosel?
Sue, are you on mute? Okay, we'll come back if necessary.
Mr. Yates?
Yes.
Mr. Honigman?
Yes.
Ms. Novosel? Checking to see if she's on. She may be on mute. She is here. And Mr. Bruce?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Okay, we will move to item 8B. That is amendments to Chapter 65 of the Code of Ordinances, Section 10.8.5 of the Rule of Procedure for the Mobility Mitigation Fee Update. Information on this item can be found on page 217. As a reminder to the public, after staff presentation and board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand at the GoToWebinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. At this point in time, I'd like to pass it over to Melanie for the presentation. Melanie, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, governing board members. Melanie Sloan here to provide more information on the mobility mitigation fee update in your packet.
Thank you.
So I'd like to start, many of you have seen this because we've been talking with committees and commission about this, but I do want to take a moment just to get us all on the same page about the reasoning and history for bringing the mobility mitigation fee update to you today. Back in April, this board adopted a new transportation and sustainable communities threshold standard for the region that used vehicle miles traveled, or VMT. It also adopted the 2020 Regional Transportation Plan and approved code changes for an updated project impact assessment process to implement that new threshold standard at the project level. And it does so by evaluating development's impact to transportation using VMT. And so what remains is to update the mobility mitigation fee. Next slide, please. Now, the project impact assessment process and also the mobility mitigation fee, as I said, is about implementing the new threshold standard at the project level. The mitigation fee also advances implementation of the regional transportation plan by providing matching funds for jurisdictions to implement projects from the regional transportation plan. And that's typically done by using the mitigation funds as matching for larger monies, state and federal grants typically. Over the past 10 years, that's been about $50,000 to $100,000 in mitigation fees collected. And while in transportation implementation, that's a small amount, those funds are actually pretty mighty because they can leverage much larger dollars. And that's how we see projects implemented in our region as well. Next slide, please. So this board provided direction to update the mitigation fee, but to keep it similar in purpose to the prior air quality mitigation fee. The update and the recommendation before you does that by really sticking to the fact that the mitigation fee is about mitigating transportation impacts of development projects. It's not to generate revenue. So the recommendation keeps to that, but does make some changes. The first, you've heard several times already, the mobility mitigation fee is a name change for the air quality mitigation fee. That fee has been in place for quite some time, so I'm sure you're familiar with it. Secondly, the projects eligible to use the mobility mitigation funds are different. They must be projects that reduce VMT. The fee calculation also is changing. And there's two ways that this changes. First, the fee rate recommendation before you uses the 2020 Regional Transportation Plan project list as the basis for calculating that fee rate. And then projects, development is charged a fee based on the net increase in VMT that it generates. Next slide, please. So how the fee recommendation is calculated. Again, the mobility mitigation fee is about reflecting the costs of mitigating increased VMT from added development. And a three-step calculation process was used to do so. And those steps ensure the fee upholds that purpose, mitigating transportation impacts of a project, and it's not to generate revenue. These steps also ensure that the fee represents development's share of future VMT. So the first step is to calculate added development's share of the VMT mitigating project costs. That's about 6.8%, and results in new development's share of project costs around $37 million. Then we divide the proportion, that amount by the proportion of VMT from added development, and then do some refinements to make sure the recommended fee rate reflects the updated project impact assessment process, as well as the historic approach to fee calculations that are continued through this update. When it comes to the refinements, it's things like recognizing location of projected development matters to the VMT it will generate, as well as assuming full occupancy for those most common development types in our region, like residences and tourist accommodation units. And then that historic and continued apportioning of fees based on whether the development's land use generates or attracts trips and its associated VMT. So as a result, the recommended fee rate is $218 per VMT. Next slide, please. So one thing I want to share is some of the basics of this update. First and foremost, it follows the simplicity developed through the project impact assessment process and the predictability provided by the online project impact assessment tool, which can be used at any time in the development process to understand the potential impact of VMT of a project, as well as the potential fees that would be charged. It also further aligns with the updated project impact assessment process by incentivizing development in low VMT areas like town and regional centers. And it does so because it recognizes lower average daily VMT in those areas and therefore lower fees. Lastly, it further incentivizes development in our town and regional centers because that's where we see most of our redevelopment occurring. And the fee is only charged on the net increase in VMT, that is the change in VMT from the prior development to the proposed development. Also, by charging on net increase in VMT, it recognizes when a project incorporates things like VMT reducing strategies or when there are jurisdiction VMT credit programs applied. Next slide, please. Within your recommendation is also we also include a waiver for the fee for deed restricted, affordable, moderate, and achievable housing when it's developed within areas eligible for residential bonus units. That is consistent with the support expressed by stakeholders as well as members of this board for reducing or waiving the fee. And we heard that throughout the update process. Additionally, the impact of the waiver is going to be evaluated on the threshold review process schedule, which is every 2 and 4 years. And if the findings from that process require adaptation to this waiver, they can be made to the program. Next slide, please. Within the packet before you are updates to the mitigation fund release policy guidelines. The significant change here for the mobility mitigation fund is to restrict the types of projects that can use those funds. Again, it's projects that reduce vehicle miles traveled. So the air quality benefiting projects, if there are air quality mitigation funds in jurisdictions' accounts, they could still apply to use those funds. And those projects, and when I mentioned these air quality benefiting projects, they might be vac trucks or street sweepers, for example. They may also qualify for water quality mitigation funds. Next slide, please. So I want to be clear that the recommendation before you had a lot of input through multiple conversations with a breadth of interested parties listed here. We also brought the recommendation to the Regional Plan Implementation Committee and the Advisory Planning Commission and then the Operations and Governments Committee. And RPIC provided unanimous support for both the fee and the waiver, as did the Operations and Governance Committee. The APC approved both, but expressed some concerns, mostly around the impact of the fee to redevelopment, especially in town and regional centers, as well as development's fair share being addressed by the project. And these two concerns I just want to share with you. I believe I've touched on those in the details of the update before you and in this presentation. And then lastly, there are concerns, especially for working with jurisdictions like Placer County that have a fee as well. And we have and will continue to collaborate and work on any of those remaining concerns throughout the implementation process for the fee. Next slide, please. With that, I turn it back to you for questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Melanie. Appreciate it. I am going to, I kind of got rid of my chat there for a second. So I don't have anybody on chat. Do I have any hands? Do I have any verbal, anybody with questions? I don't see any. Okay. So let's go to public comment. If any member of the public wishes to address the governing board on this agenda item, please raise your hand now and go to webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff. And I'll turn it over to Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a hand raised. Lynn Barnett, if you unmute yourself, you can address the governing board.
Hi, Lynn.
Hello, can you hear me?
I can.
Yes, thank you. Hi, I'm Lynn Barnett. I'm president of St. Joseph Community Land Trust. We submitted a letter yesterday asking the governing board to consider adding to the list of VMT reducing projects a funding program for affordable housing. If affordable housing is in fact a strategy being used to reduce VMT, we're hoping that the governing board would recognize that partnering or helping affordable housing projects get off the ground is helpful. And there's currently no local funding sources for affordable housing. So at this point, I don't have a an amount that we would request. Beggars can't be choosers, if you will. But if it was tiered somehow to the potential amount of VMT savings, and think about the workers at Lake Tahoe driving many miles to get affordable housing and keeping them local, we think that the VMT savings should incorporate those miles in the basin that are reduced, but also outside the basin. We are part of the rest of the planet after all. So I just would like the governing board to consider if today is not the appropriate day to put it on your radar screen, but we would like to see some of these mitigation fees dedicated to help with funding of affordable and moderate income housing projects. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lynn. Appreciate it. Anybody else, Catherine?
No, Mr. Chair, there are no other hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Okay, maybe staff can connect with Lynn on his idea. Okay, so if nobody has any further questions, comments, I don't see any, do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, this is Cindy. I'll make that motion.
Great, thank you. And it's the motion is to adopt the findings, including finding of no significant effect, as set forth in Exhibit 1 to Attachment B. Is that correct, John?
That is correct. They're also on the screen.
Yeah.
Thanks. I'm in my car, so a little challenging to read that. Thanks.
Okay. So let's, can somebody make the motion? I think it's just going to be easier. Cindy, I'm sorry if someone just made the motion reading off of the screen, unless, John, you think it's okay that Cindy just make the motion as stated on the screen, one at a time.
I'd like the motion to be articulated, please.
Okay. Anybody?
Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt findings, including a finding of no significant effect as set forth in Exhibit 1.
Okay, we have a motion. Roll call, please, Maria.
Ms. Saldin?
Yes.
Ms. Conrad Sadoff?
Yes.
Mr. Woloshin?
Yes.
Ms. Faustinos? Ms. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Friedrich?
Yes.
Mr. Lawrence?
Yes.
Ms. Gustafson?
Yes.
Mr. Rice?
Yes.
Mr. Honigman?
Yes.
Ms. Williamson?
Yes.
Ms. Novosel?
Yes.
Mr. Yates?
Yes.
Mr. Bruce?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Thank you so much. Do I have another motion?
I further move to adopt Ordinance 21-, amending Ordinance 2019-03, as previously amended, to amend the Code of Ordinances as set forth in Exhibit 3.
Thank you. We have a motion. Mari, would you please take the roll?
Ms. Conrad Seda? Is that yes?
Yes.
Thank you. Ms. Alden?
Yes.
Ms. Faustinos? Mr. Woloshin?
Yes.
Mr. Friedrich?
I'm not sure you heard me yet.
Okay. Thank you. Broke up a little. Ms. Hill?
Ms. Hill? Yeah. Thank you.
Ms. Gustafson?
Yes.
Mr. Lawrence?
Yes.
Mr. Honigman?
Yes.
Mr. Rice?
Yes.
Ms. Novosel?
Yes.
Ms. Williamson?
Yes.
Mr. Yates?
Yes.
Mr. Bruce?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, the motion passes.
Thank you. And do I have a third and final motion?
And finally, I move to adopt Resolution 21-, to amend the rules of procedure as set forth in Exhibit 4.
We have a motion. Mari, would you please take the roll?
Mr. Yates?
Yes.
Ms. Williamson?
Yes.
Ms. Novosel?
Yes.
Mr. Honigman?
Yes.
Mr. Rice?
Yes.
Ms. Gustafson?
Yes.
Mr. Lawrence?
Yes.
Mr. Friedrich?
Yes.
Ms. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Faustinos? Mr. Woloshin?
Yes.
Ms. Conrad Sato?
Yes.
Ms. Alding?
Yes.
Mr. Bruce?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, motion passes.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We'll move to item number 9, reports. Joanne, do you have an executive director status report for us?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I first want to say to the board members, it's not our usual practice to abuse all of you by not this up today. And we will do better next month. You know, we typically build in a lunch break and we just biffed it today. So we'll take, I'll just extend my apologies to you for that and we'll do better. A couple brief things this month. I wanted to call out to you an item that was on consent, which was our local government coordination report. And I think it's important to acknowledge the good work of local governments on the delegated implementation of our regional plan. I asked Brandy McMahon, who did all the heavy lifting on that report, to give you a really high level overview of the results this year, because our local governments really performed well. And so I hope you'll just indulge her for a few minutes while she hits the highlights of that report, because I think it's worth putting on the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Julianne, would you like me to give an overview?
Please.
All right, thank you. Sorry about that. I was muted for a moment and then got
unmuted. No worries.
So anyways, it's good to see you all virtually. My name is Brandy McMahon. I am TRPA's local government coordinator. And today I've been asked to provide you highlights of the local government coordination report that was in today's packet and that you approved on consent this morning. And so that action recertifies all the local government area plans and reveals very positive outcomes from permitting that is delegated to Tahoe's local jurisdictions to implement the regional plan goals and policies, which serve as a guide for future land use decisions within the Tahoe region. And to further these goals and policies, the 2012 regional plan encourages local jurisdictions to develop area plans to make progress towards environmental threshold attainment. So with the adoption of the Washoe County Tahoe area plan earlier this year, we now have 6 area plans, with at least one in each local jurisdiction, covering over 70,000 acres, or 34% of the land area of the Tahoe region, and 89% of town centers, which are the areas targeted for environmental redevelopment under the regional plan. To streamline the permitting process and facilitate the implementation of environmentally beneficial projects once an area plan is adopted, the regional plan encourages local jurisdictions to take on permitting on behalf of the agency. This is achieved by entering into a delegation memorandum of understanding, or MOU. And once an MOU is approved by the governing board, TRPA provides ongoing training to local jurisdictions and then conducts annual permitting audits. All of the California local jurisdictions, this includes the city of South Lake Tahoe, El Dorado County, and Placer County, are currently reviewing projects on behalf of TRPA pursuant to an MOU, and all 3 jurisdictions have designated MOU liaisons that work closely with TRPA to ensure projects are being implemented in accordance with area plans. At the request of Douglas and Washoe counties, TRPA is currently reviewing all projects in the Nevada portion of the Tahoe Basin. So as you read in this year's annual report, in 2020, all of the local jurisdictions received scores of 90% or greater on their residential project review and compliance audits. And the city of South Lake Tahoe, which is the only jurisdiction that is elected to take on larger commercial, tourist, and public service projects, was found, based on a review of their projects, to be implementing projects in accordance with their area plans. So as a result, staff recommended that the governing board recertify the local jurisdiction MOUs. To ensure that the area plans are in conformance with the Lake Tahoe Total Maximum Daily Load, or the TMDL program, TRPA code also requires the agency use catchment data and all reports to inform the 4-year area plan recertification. The TMDL program guides efforts to restore Lake Tahoe's clarity to depths of nearly 100 feet. And to meet this goal, the program aims to reduce the amount of fine sediment, particles, nitrogen, and phosphorus entering the lake. So since it has been 4 years since the last area plan recertification, the governing board was asked to recertify all of the area plans for the next 4 years because all local jurisdictions are meeting or exceeding their credit targets. And so today I'm just summarizing all the good work that the local jurisdictions are doing to carry out the regional plan. I'd just like to, highlight that everyone this year has had a lot of challenges as a result of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. We've all experienced an increase in workload from people relocating to the Tahoe Basin. There's been issues with retaining and hiring staff due to the housing cost. And then there's been the recent disruptions caused by the fires. But despite these challenges, the local jurisdictions are continuing to work as great partners in carrying out the goals for the larger Tahoe region and the regional plan. So I just want to thank all of you for working with TRPA throughout this past year. And if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. I thought it was important that we hear that summary of that report. And Brandy did a really nice job of that. So any questions, any comments? I'm not seeing any, but I thought that was important. Joanne, did you have anything further on your status report?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Julie has a really quick legislative announcement, and then I'll wrap really quickly.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Joanne. Very briefly, last month we mentioned the passage of what's known as the infrastructure bill in the United States Congress. It was a big week for the country, and I wanted to update you all that we had the opportunity to participate with California's U.S. Senator Alex Padilla just last week in a live Facebook broadcast where myself and Jesse Patterson from the League to Save Lake Tahoe were really honored to represent Team Tahoe to have this conversation with Senator Padilla about the infrastructure bill, which is now law, and what that means for Tahoe. $17 million will come to Lake Tahoe in the form of a five-year appropriation of about $3.4 million, which will aid us in that fight and the battle that we've spent all day talking about with invasive species. So on the control side, the prevention side, and hearing it straight from one important member of our delegation was just a real honor. And that was included, the link, in the list that Jeff Cowan, our public information officer, sent around to you all last week in all the links of TRPA and Tahoe News. We plan to have these conversations with other members of our Senate delegation and other members of Team Tahoe will be hosting them in the future. Just wanted to mention that. In addition, along those lines of invasive species, as you all heard today about the program, the initiative underway in the Keys, another big news item hit the streets today. The Forest Service, the Tahoe Fund, our partners, announced the commencement of the Taylor to Lac invasive weeds program. To date, 17 acres is the largest that's been undertaken. So you'll be seeing that in news clips going around. It's a public-private partnership. The Tahoe Fund has raised private money to put into that project, and TRPA is very pleased to be partnering with the Forest Service and the Lahontan Water Board in taking a lead on this really critical program over at Baldwin Beach. The area is the largest functioning wetland in the basin. So and more good news in the fight of invasive species. Just wanted to share those with you. And thanks for your stamina and attention today.
Thank you, Julie. Okay, Joanne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a quick thank you to our human resources director, Susan Strading, who is retiring. We're in the process of hiring new HR help, but we celebrated her at our recent all staff, and we will toast her out at an event tomorrow afternoon. I just wanted to extend my deep appreciation and thanks for her service here at TRPA and all the good work that she did. And lastly, I want to wish all of you a happy holiday. We'll be back after the first of the year, and we will see all of you again. But I do hope that you enjoy some healthy time with family and friends over the holidays. So that's my report today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And John Marshall, we'll go to your report.
Jelly, do I get credit?
You know, I really miss that jacket, John, but there it is in all its glory. Thank you. I feel much more festive already.
All right. No major reports, except that we did file for protective purposes three pieces of enforcement litigation with the help of Steve Sweet and Catherine Hangalon over illegal mooring off of Reagan Beach by pontoon boats that were essentially for rental purposes. So we'll be seeking civil penalties. Hopefully this will motivate the individuals to negotiate with us and we can resolve them out of court. But otherwise we'll be proceeding with these enforcement actions. That's it. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you for bringing your coat. Okay, we're going to move to the governing board member reports. Do I have any governing board member reports? If you do, please raise your hand or speak up. I see no chat. I see no hands. So we will move.
I'll give a quick report.
Oh, pardon me?
Mr. Chair, I'll give a quick report.
Okay.
John.
Go ahead.
Just a couple items that I think may have been of interest to the governing board and public. City of South Lake Tahoe Council last week adopted a resolution that we consider the most ambitious renewable energy resolution of any municipality in the country for 100% renewable at all time periods connected to our local grid, completely decarbonized grid by 2030. So we're excited about that. Happy to compare notes with any other jurisdiction interested in partnering in that type of effort. We also moved to pursue dark sky procurement standards for our city lighting. So more, lower color temperature lights, less glare, so it kind of fits in with that sustainable tourism objective. So just wanted to share those two bits of information.
Great. Thank you so much. Not seeing any other hands, we will move to committee reports. And I'll just ask it a little bit here. Local government and housing.
No report. Happy holidays, okay. Everybody.
Thank you. Legal committee, that's me, no report. Operations and governance, Shelley?
Nothing further, thank you.
EI Transportation Public Outreach, Jim?
Yeah, thank you, Mark. The committee met this morning. We had really great participation. I think everybody was able to make it except for one member. Again, the focus of the committee meeting has been like it has been last few meetings, and that's focusing on finding sustainable revenue for transportation systems and transit. We heard a report from the consultant who's been working with various groups, including the Bi-State Consultation. And there seemed to be a certain amount of momentum and consensus to, while it doesn't solve everything, but to do some pilot projects, two pilot projects, one being sort of a corridor parking user fee along the Highway 28 corridor, which is really probably the most congested recreation corridor on the Nevada side, and then a similar type of pilot project on Highway 89, the Emerald Bay Area in California. Certainly, there's a lot of questions that would need to be answered. It was sort of an initial presentation. The committee had a lot of good comments regarding needing to raise enough money to make sure it's not just for O&M, but also to build that transit system that folks will use. Also, some discussions regarding administration and how that could look. Basically gave guidance to the consultants to do the deeper dive on those two pilot projects and come back with really kind of more of a, more flesh on the bone, so to speak, regarding the proposal. So it was a good meeting. We met for over an hour. I really appreciate the participation of the committee members, and I would also like to welcome Ashley based on the vote this afternoon, and I'm looking forward to having Ashley participate on the committee as well. And Excellent. With that, I would just wish everybody happy holidays.
Thank you so much, Jim. Really appreciate it. Forest health and wildfire. Bud.
Thank you, Mark. Yes. In January, we hope to be able to present to the governing board the proposed amendments to the ordinances, which will allow the use of mechanical equipment for thinning and clearance purposes on slopes of 30% to 50%. Something we've been working on for years, and we're really looking forward to having this. With that said, happy holidays to everybody. And if I can quote my favorite Western philosopher, happy trails to all of you in the new year.
Thank you. Thanks, bud. Our pick, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do look forward to working with Bud and his committee on those changes to the code that will be required for us to be able to implement those changes necessary for fuel reduction, especially on the steep slopes. I'm grateful for the fine work that Susan Stradian had done for the organization. I'm sorry to learn that she's leaving. I know when I was chair and we were dealing with personnel matters, Susan was very, very helpful, and I wish her well. And I'm also grateful that Joanne is back, that we had a holiday party. I was able to get up there. We probably couldn't do that this Monday, but we got there that last Monday, and it was great to see Vince and Ashley and get to know them a little bit, and just had a good time. It's nice to have some face-to-face with folks again. And I wish all of you a very happy holidays and look forward to 2022.
Thank you so much, Bill. Just before we get into the last public comment period, it's been one heck of a year. We've had a lot of amazingly positive things happen. We've had a lot of challenges. I think it's time, in the next 15 days or so before we get ramped up into the next year, to give ourselves a little bit of a break, to think about all the good things that we have. To think about all the good things that we can do next year for each other. Just very thankful to be a part of this group. And I want to thank everybody for doing all that you do to make this organization the best it can be, to do everything we can to protect and to make better Lake Tahoe. And have a great next couple weeks. So with that, we will go to public comment. And I'm hoping that Catherine can read all of the rules so that I don't have to.
My pleasure, Mr. Chair. The final matter of business is the general public comment interest period. Any member of the public wishing to address the governing board on any item listed or not listed on the agenda, including items on the consent calendar, may do so at this time. Individuals or groups who have already commented on items listed on the agenda are not permitted to comment on that same topic. The governing board is prohibited by law from taking immediate action on or discussing issues raised by the public during this comment period. The board will hear comments on any single topic not on the agenda for up to, but not to exceed, 30 minutes. The board will hear as many unique comments as possible, and they will hear comments for up to, but no more than a total of 60 minutes. All unheard comments can be submitted via email to mambler@trpa.gov and will be forwarded to all governing board members. If any member of the public wishes to speak at this time, please raise your hand in the GoToWebinar, which is on the left-hand side of your control panel, and I will unmute you and indicate that you have the floor to address the board. Mr. Chair, there are no hands raised to make a comment.
Well, then it looks like we're going to have one final vote, and that's to adjourn. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, have a wonderful holiday.